Matter of Practices Omnibus Bill will be in order. A quorum is present. The first thing I'd like to do is just say good afternoon to everyone. Thank you for being here to join us. We are have a lot of things in our omnibus bill this year, and so we are going to try to move through this in as organized a fashion as possible. Just to let everyone in the room know, because of other scheduling concerns, we are going to be breaking today around 4 o'clock. If we happen to be through, we will all be very happy. If not, we'll let you know certainly by tomorrow morning, if not the end of the day when we've rescheduled our second meeting. So at this point, I think we're going to go around the room and give everyone an opportunity to introduce themselves briefly, beginning with Senator Scheid.
Yes, I'm Linda Scheid. Represent Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park in the state Senate, and Representative Hillstrom and Mike Nelson are the two representatives from our district. That helps.
Thank you.
I'm Warren Limmer, a state senator from Maple Grove in northwest Hennepin County and maybe 125 houses in Wright County.
Meanwhile, I represent the east side of St. Paul. Sheldon Johnson and Tim Mahoney are my state reps.
We can go back to Senator Betzel.
I'm Don Betzold. I represent parts of Fridley, Springley Park, Lane, and Mound View. My state representatives are Tom Tilbury and Scott Kranz.
Kathy?
I'm Kathy Pontius, counselor for the Judiciary Committee.
Senator Mary Olson. I represent Senate District 4 from just north of Brainerd up through north of Bemidji, and I chair the Data Practices Subcommittee in the Senate.
Steve Simon, State House from 44A, which is Hopkins and St. Louis Park, and Ron Latz is my state senator.
I'm Matt Gehring from the House Research Department.
Good afternoon. Chris DeLaForest, District 49A, Andover and Ham Lake in Anoka County. Kathy Tingelstead is my seatmate over on the B side, representing Coon Rapids, and Debbie Johnson is our state senator. Madam Chair, good afternoon to you. I don't believe we've ever met. I know I've got familiar faces, especially from the 35W Conference Committee, but especially hello to you, Madam Chair.
Nice to meet you. Very nice to meet you.
I'm John Lesh. I represent District 66A, the north end, east side of St. Paul, and parts of Como Park. This is my sixth legislative session. My seatmate on the B-half is Alice Hausman, and my senator is Ellen Anderson.
Very good. And I should say, since everyone else has mentioned their seatmates, I'm very sad that my seatmate, Representative Frank Moe, won't be with us again under any circumstances, I guess, regardless of the election, since he's decided not to run again. And I also, he's the representative in the northern part of my district, and Representative Larry Howes is the representative on the southern part of my district. So,
Madam Chair,
yes.
I should mention, too, this is Representative DeLaForest's swan song as well. So.
Oh,
yes. Getting out.
Well, I'm glad I'm going to have a chance to work with you then. And also, just to let you know, for Representative Simon and I have talked beforehand and decided upon kind of a format for how we're planning to proceed through things. The first thing we'll do is both Mr. Gehring and Kathy Pontius are going to walk us through the side-by-side. We have a number of similar or identical provisions in the House and Senate omnibus bills. Then I think we have about five provisions on the Senate side that are not included in the House bill, and 20-some provisions, over 20 provisions in the House bill that aren't in the Senate bill. But the provisions in the Senate side are maybe larger, more complex provisions. And so what we'll do is we'll go through the side-by-sides, then we will probably move to adopt everything that's same and similar, and then we'll just start back at the beginning and go through the things that are only in one bill or the other. It won't be our intention to take testimony unless someone here on the conference committee requests clarification or further discussion that might be able to be provided by someone in the audience, or unless it seems, just kind of as we go, if it seems necessary to have some clarification. But we won't want to kind of go through and duplicate everything we did in our earlier committees. Okay, any questions before we get started or any comments? Okay, then I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Kathy Pontius to start our side-by-side comparison.
Madam Chair and members, the first section of both bills is identical. This is a provision in the that allows the state auditor, under current law, if somebody provides data to them, they can ask the person to review it, to verify it, before releasing a report. And this requires that person to prevent the data from unlawful disclosure. And again, that's identical in both bills. And then Section 2 is also identical in both bills. This amends the statute that governs fees that a government entity can charge for providing copies of data and other services, and it eliminates the authorization for a fee for compiling copies. And then I'll defer to Mr. Gehring, because next we have a couple of House-only provisions.
Madam Chair, Sections 3 and 4 of the House version of the bill deal with the cap on damages for violations of the Data Practices Act. The cap is increased in Section 3 for a willful violation of the Data Practices Act from the existing damages of $100 to $10,000 to $5,000 to $50,000 total for each violation of the Act. Section 4 of the House bill increases the potential penalty against a government entity if a court has to issue an order to compel compliance with the Data Practices Act. Currently, the court can impose a civil penalty of up to $300. The bill would increase that potential civil penalty to up to $3,000.
Madam Chair? Oh, Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, may we ask questions as we go through, or do you prefer to go through the whole bill before we ask questions?
Senator Moore, it was my intention, if there's a question about a clarification, then I think it's fine to ask it now. But I think if we're going to get into discussion, we want to try to walk through the whole bill first, and then we'll come back and go through the provisions kind of one at a time that we have.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Section 5 of the House version of the bill establishes a cross-reference to a substantive provision that's can be found in Section 24 of the bill. This is a cross-reference related to data on applicants for automated parking at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. The substantive provision classifies the data that's collected when a person uses a credit card or other type of identification to enter a parking facility at the airport. Section 6 of the House bill is similarly a House-only provision. This section would prohibit a health insurance company from surveying public employees for purposes of assessing the health of that individual or the health of the collective group of employees.
And then, Madam Chair, members, on Senate Section 3 is a Senate-only provision in this bill, at least. It authorizes the sharing of data between the Department of Education and the Office of Higher Education, and it's for purposes of improving instruction in school districts. And this language is moving in a couple of other different places in the House and Senate. I believe on the Senate side, it's also in the higher ed policy bill. And I think on the House side, it's in the K-12 education policy bill. And I think that language is identical in all these places. And then the next provision are nearly identical. It's House and Senate provisions that amend the civil investigative data statute. Most of these are technical terminology changes. I will point out one substantive difference. If you look on the House side on R5 on House language, page 5, line 30, and the circumstances under which a government entity can release investigative data, which otherwise is confidential, it adds that it may be released if the entity determines that it will aid the investigative process. And that part is not in the Senate language. Otherwise, it's identical on both sides. And then I'll defer back to Mr. Gehring for the licensing data statute amendments.
Madam Chair, there's a number of sections in the House version of the bill. House Sections 7, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 26 that come from an initiative from the Department of Administration related to civil investigative and licensing data. These sections collectively modify the definition of licensing data and also affect circumstances under which certain data can be released.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I can defer to Ms. Pontius for the sections on school background checks.
Oh, Madam Chair, member too, I think there is another house only permission.
Section 8.
So starts on the bottom of R7 and then R8 on the data on applicants for elective or appointed office.
I think, Mr. Gehring, this was about private information, that
right.
section.
Madam Chair, these sections, as Ms. Pontius said, are currently only in the House version of the bill. These sections classify data on applicants for appointment to a public body and also data on actual appointees to a public body. These provisions come as a result of temporary classification from the Commissioner of Administration that classified certain data on these people as private. The House version of the bill would classify certain information on applicants for appointment as private, but also specify information that is sort of information that you'd find on a resume as public information on applicants for appointment. Once an appointee is actually appointed to a public body, they also are required to have listed publicly a full mailing address, a telephone number, and email address where the appointee can be reached. There's a similar provision in Section 15 of the House version of the bill related to election of elected officials. In this case, elected officials are required to designate at least one telephone number, email address, and postal mail address where they can be contacted about official business.
And then I believe, Mr. Gehring, we also had on the top of R9 something about explosives.
Right. Madam Chair, Section 16 of the House version of the bill sort of correlates with Sections 20 and 21. These sections deal with the classification of the location and planned use of explosives in the state of Minnesota. The provisions would classify the data as non-public, so when a person or an entity applies for an application to use explosives in the state, the information in the application that would designate where the explosives are stored or where they're planned to be used would be classified as non-public, so a person would not be able to make a public information request for that information.
Madam Chair, then back to the Senate side on R9, Sections 6 to 8 amend the background check statute applicable to employees and volunteers in school districts. And there's three parts. One is a notice requirement where an individual who's the subject of a background check has to be informed if their status has been denied as a result of a background check. It also amends the definition of a school to include an intermediate school district, and then adds a definition of security violation, which is then used in Section 8, and this governs situations where a school might use a third-party contractor to do the criminal history background check, and I believe that this is a separate bill, Senator Simons, that's currently on the House floor. There are some minor stylistic differences between this language and what's on the House floor, but I think the substance is the same between the two bills.
Madam Chair, Section 17 of the House version of the bill, which is on page R10, and R11, actually, is where the new language can be found, requires the Commissioner of Health to consult with the Health Services Policy Committee and develop some standards and potential legislation to facilitate the dissemination of certain medical assistance and health insurance data to research institutions for purposes of facilitating their research into the effectiveness of healthcare treatment and outcomes. The data that would be shared and disseminated to these institutions would be required to be basically summary data and not identify specific individuals.
Then, Madam Chair, members, Section 18 is an identical provision in both bills. It just corrects a cross-reference in the statute governing juvenile records maintained by peace officers. That runs through until R13, which then is a house-only provision.
Madam Chair, the Section 19 of the House version of the bill The new language can be found on page R14. It does two things. The first thing is it allows the Department of Employment and Economic Development to share data with the Department of Corrections on individuals who are confined within the department for purposes of identifying appropriate employment opportunities or employment assignments for individuals who are confined. The data would be used for both pre-confinement and post-confinement case planning on those individuals. The section on lines 14.3 to 14.5 required that any inmate whose immigration status cannot be determined is public, and the section would require the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development to compile a list of those individuals whose immigration status isn't determined and submit that list to the Federal Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And Madam Chair, sections 20 and 21 I've already mentioned are the substantive data provisions related to explosives data. Section 22 on page R15, the House version prohibits the use of social security numbers on the face of mailings. A government entity would be prohibited from sending or causing to be sent or delivered in the mail a document or a mailing of some type that would list a person's social security number on the face of the envelope or in a way that would make the social security number of an individual visible from the inside of the envelope. The entity is also prohibited from sort of the reverse situation. They're prohibited from requiring a person to mail back a document that would show their social security number on the face of the document or visible from the inside of the mailing.
I was just saying we don't have Senator Higgins here to work on that language of that, yeah. of that paragraph, because to me it's a little confusing, but we'll get to that later. So,
Madam Chair, her protege, Senator Scheid, is here.
Senator Scheid, you might want to start wordsmithing that.
I'm looking at it.
Do we have an amendment? Oh, great. Okay.
Madam Chair, members, then the next one is a Senate-only provision that starts on R15. This is the business screening services, and this provision has a history going back to last session. Actually, it was a separate bill on both the House and Senate, which passed out of committee but was on the floor at the end of session, and so it was referred back to committee. And the main issue that was holding it up was how this provision of law interplayed with the requirements of the Fair Credit Reporting Act and the extent that it was preempted or covered under that act. On the Senate side, there was language added this year that tried to clarify the interplay between the two. And I believe it came up in committee in the House but did not pass out of House committee this year.
Members, I think you all have in your materials a memo that Ms. Pontius wrote over the interim that addresses that issue. So if you want to read that, if you're interested in going through that, it's included in your materials.
Madam Chair, the final unique House provision is Section 23, which can be found on page R17. This provision relates to the Hennepin County Medical Center, and it would permit HCMC to exchange medical data and with other entities within the HCMC facility for purposes of treatment and healthcare operations activities. It also modifies the definition of related healthcare entities to facilitate the new language that's in the bill. Madam Chair, Section 24 I mentioned previously is the airport, the substantive provision related to airport parking spaces.
Yeah, and then, Madam Chair and members, the final major section is the marriage dissolution petition and the treatment of Social Security numbers, and this is identical in both bills.
Madam Chair, Section 26, which is at the end of page R19, is related to the civil investigative and licensing data language I discussed earlier.
Okay. At this point, I think that Representative Simon has a motion.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. If it's in order, I'd like to move adoption of the same or similar language, which, to my reading anyway, would be House language in House Sections 1, 2, it would be 8, 15 and 25.
Representative Simon has moved the adoption of House Sections 1, 2, 8, 18, and 25 to be included in the Conference Committee report. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? None. Motion passes. Now, I believe, if I've counted correctly, we have 14 provisions to go through that are included only in one bill or the other. And so I think what we'll do is just start back to the beginning. And on page R2-1, section beginning on line 3.16, action for damages. And committee members, just for those of you, Senator Scheid, weren't on the data practices subcommittee. These are provisions that we heard last session, and so the Senate did take a position on these sections, in that we did not adopt them in terms of damages increase. And I can share with the committee that I have had some conversations in my office, and some concerns have been expressed on behalf of cities that, you know, obviously if we increase penalties, there's going to be a potential financial concern that they will have to address. But I can also share, and I don't want to just say any names, but I think it's been pretty much generally acknowledged that because we have such large disparity between the penalty for releasing information that should not be released, the penalty there under existing statute is $10,000. And we have a very relatively much smaller penalty for not releasing information that should be released. The penalty there is only $100. That across the board, and it's the advice often given to government officials is, when in doubt, don't release the information. And I don't know if that the penalties are driving that or if it's a concern for privacy, but it seems as though that seems to be acknowledged as the type of information that's given, or the advice that's given. It seems to me that, at least from my perspective, it's equally as important that we are releasing information to the public that they are entitled to receive as it is that we are protecting people's privacy where it should be protected. I know these are very complicated statutes, and sometimes people are confused about what they should be doing, but I think we really want to encourage, from my perspective, at least a more level playing field as far as the penalties. So my suggestion, and Representative Simon and I have talked about this, I'm not sure exactly if he concurs with me or not, but my suggestion would be that one compromise we might want to consider would be perhaps not increasing the penalty for releasing information, but increasing the accepting the increase of penalty for not releasing information, so that the two are at least closer together. So I'm just going to kind of throw that out there to start the discussion or conversation, and I'd be interested in whatever comments or remarks anyone else or may have. Representative Simon?
Well, Madam Chair, I think ultimately Representative De La Forest, who is one of our conferees, was responsible for sort of the godfather of this provision, but it's one that I had supported at least at the committee level before. I just want to, if we could get a clarification from staff, I see here on R2, basically, we're just talking about the range, which now for violations, regardless of whether what kind of violation, is between $100,000 and $10,000, and what the new suggested language would propose was a new range of $5,000 to $50,000. Can staff just clarify here the understanding about what violations, if any, are treated separately or differently? I just had always thought here in on the left column of R2 that we're dealing with a violation of whatever kind is between this range.
Maybe that's true.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, the first provision, which is House Section 3, I mean, it refers to any violation of the statute where somebody's damaged. Now, I think in reality, most of the times, that's because information's been released that shouldn't have been released, although it could theoretically work the other way if somebody didn't get information they should have and they had damages as a result. Mm-hmm. And then those are, right now, it's not less than $100 or more than $10,000. And that's in a case where there's a willful violation as well. And then, but then the next one is specifically in a case where it's an action to compel compliance, which again is most likely going to be because the government entity is withholding access rather than releasing information that they shouldn't be.
Okay. Senator Moi?
Madam Chair, I was going to ask a question from earlier. Is that, and I'm sorry, I may have not heard you. Did you say that this section three had a Senate companion? Do we have Senate language?
No, Madam, or Senator Moi. I'm used to saying Madam Chair. It does not have Senate companion because we considered this language not this year but last year, and we did not adopt it. And so our position was to reject the increase. So we did consider it, but we did not adopt it.
Madam Chair, was there a bill?
I believe there was a bill last year, Senator Moi, and we heard it in data practices.
And Madam Chair, and maybe the House members can tell me, was this a bill that was considered, or?
Oh, okay. Senator Moi, just as a correction, it was not a bill that we heard in Senate. So I guess the reason I'm recalling it is because it was in the House Conference Committee data omnibus bill last year, but we did not adopt it, right?
Right.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple other questions. The first one was, is how long ago have we altered this range for damages? Do we know that? Does council, do they know when we've visited this last?
Representative De La Forest, do you know?
Madam Chair, thank you. And to the best of my knowledge, these damage amounts have not been altered since they were first put into law. And I know we have some folks sitting in the audience who could probably answer the question, but I believe with respect even to what we find in the action for damages on R2, that decades ago, I believe. It's been some time, Senator Limmer, to the best of my knowledge. As a matter of fact, never altered, to the best of my knowledge.
One of the other references, and I don't know, not being an attorney, I don't know if this word means anything, but on line page 323, the liability is for exemplary damages. Does that mean anything that for the purposes of this discussion?
My understanding, Senator Limper, is that that's talking about something beyond it's more in the way of a penalty, and maybe Ms. Pontius can give us some, or either one of you, if you want to jump in and give us. But I think it's regardless of whether you have actual damages, for example, medical bills or lost wages or something like that, that it's more in the way of a penalty for the violation that would be within the discretion of the courts. And I would assume that the range would be determined more on the basis of how onerous the violation was as opposed to the person's actual damages, I'm guessing. Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chair, or Senator Olson, yes, I mean, and it is cases where there's a willful violation. So before that can even kick in, there has to be a willful violation. And exemplary is a term that's sometimes used kind of interplayed with punitive, but it's a little different in that if you want punitive damages, you have to go under the punitive damage statute, which is much higher burden of proof and a higher threshold of conduct. So it is a kind of something between damages and punitive, but it's a kind of penalty.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Limmer, I would just add that you may be familiar with the punitive damages, like the McDonald's case, the coffee on the lap, where people thought that was an onerous award. And in this case, often it also relates to the size of the actor who violates. So McDonald's being very large, in order to sting them adequately, it had to be large enough, which is how it's geared toward from the court, at least in that case, would be the same way, which I think is why the request for it being higher.
I'm wondering if you know, if we can either have more discussion about this, or does it? Last year, I think we were maybe had some testimony from this or about this, and we were hesitant to. I'm not sure if I can even. Does anyone want to help me out, or can you enlighten me about the reason we didn't adopt this last year?
Madam Chair, I know I brought up numerous times in data privacy the failure of Minnesota statute not to have consequences for violating our data privacy laws. Now, that can be applied both to private transactions as well as public. But Minnesota talks a good game about data privacy, but it doesn't always put the bite in the teeth in the law that some of us think is necessary. Now, in this isolated case, we're dealing with a government entity. The court has to, or you have to find that there's been damages, and they've been willful damages. So it's a little bit more of an aggravated act. And I don't understand, or I don't recall what we did in the last year or two on this particular provision that we discussed, or whether we did or not. I don't know if we even rejected the bill when it came before us.
It wasn't a bill, it was a conference committee last year.
Well, a conference committee last year. Reference.
So. Madam Chair.
Senator Shine?
Madam Chair, may I inquire of the House if this was a bill in the House, or was it an amendment?
Representative De La Forest?
Madam Chair, thank you. Just to add a little bit of history to this particular provision, it's had a number of different permutations, and it started out back in 03 with me with a bill generally, and it generally didn't go anywhere for various reasons. It got stopped somewhere along the way, and so I admit I got somewhat discouraged with it, went to a method where I just brought out an amendment for the data practices bill. So for those who have observed that this was not a bill this year, that is correct. But Madam Chair, you're also recalling with some accuracy that this particular issue has been talked about by the House and the Senate and their conference committees with respect to data practices for about 5 or 6 years now. So the issue has been around in various forms. But Senator Moy, I know he had the question. This year it did not appear in bill form, and probably an oversight on my part. I probably should have put it in bill form, so I apologize for that. But it was inserted as an amendment. And now, if I could, Madam Chair, just speak for a couple of moments with respect to why I think the penalties ought to be increased to some level. This wasn't something that I sort of just came up with on my own. I spoke with a number of attorneys who practice in this area and a number of folks who are familiar with it, and there's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there that there appears to be a decent amount of pressure being put on public employees to either withhold data more often than not, or release data, or outright alter data. And it's hard to get any hard statistics on this because, obviously, people are loath to risk their livelihood and their reputation in the community by crossing policymakers who allegedly are ordering this. But I have had, personally, a number of phone calls with public employees who have been very distressed with respect to their situation, which they've been asked to somehow not comply with Chapter 13. And the reason why I think it's important to enhance the penalties is it ought to sting. I mean, the Data Practices Act is our sunshine law. This is the legislation that protects citizens. This is our chapter of statutes that shines the light on government. And if you believe that, you should believe that the penalties ought to be enhanced in some way. I mean, think about the top of the range. By the way, for a willful, and that means something. That's a term of art. For a willful violation, an intentional violation, $10,000. I mean, goodness, the city of Andover, I just live in a sleepy suburb, Madam Chair. We got a $7 million city budget. $10,000 certainly isn't a lot. And so I think that it ought to be changed because the penalty, and Representative Simon tells a sort of eloquent story about a client of his. I mean, violations of data practices can ruin people. I mean, I understand that it's complex and it can be somewhat onerous for government, but it can be absolutely ruinous. And where do you go to get your reputation back if there's a violation? And so I don't discount the concerns of local government. I don't discount them. but I think a presumption needs to be made and the balance needs to swing in favor of citizens who are supposed to be protected by this law. So it's for that reason I think that the penalties ought to be enhanced in some way.
Representative De La Forest, and then I'll take your question, Representative Lesh, but I was just being reminded that the reason that we did not adopt this last year was because since it had not been introduced as a bill, there was some concern on the part of the Senate that we didn't have an opportunity to hear, kind of get the full story out. And considering that we would be making, on the high end, a 500% increase in the penalty, I agree with you in theory. So I really do, and I've handled some cases myself, especially in situations trying to get information where it wasn't available and could see the harm that was caused by the delay. Some things are time sensitive, and if you don't get the information in a timely way, you really can't recover from that, and yet trying to prove actual damages is sometimes an impossibility in these situations. But I'm concerned unless we want to take the time to get some testimony from local government, if we adopt your position without hearing anything from the other side. Representative Lesh and then Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One comment and then several questions, or two questions. One comment being, Madam Chair, your initial discussion about parity between release of information that shouldn't have been released versus refusal to release information to which a claiming party was entitled. I guess I wanted to speak to that and say that I think there is a difference, and I think in the policy we make, maybe in my mind, there should be a difference in that I'm sure that some other individuals think it should have parity. For example, newspapers who see themselves as watchdog for the public, they see that as a huge violation. But I think I'm in the same boat with Representative De La Forest saying, you know, I expect that my information as a citizen ought to be held paramount above and beyond. And I think it's a greater violation to disclose that, which is ruinous of an individual, versus disclosing a refusal to disclose information which an entity had. So I just wanted to make that comment. The two questions are, number one, is either Senate counsel or House Research or even Representative De La Forest in your conversations with attorneys familiar with typical cases or have any cases whereby a judge has declined to award an appropriate damage, for example, just come in at the $100 minimum damage to make an example, and where are these awards coming in the violations of these cases? Secondarily, is proving your case in this matter in order to get exemplary damages similar to the threshold to achieve exemplary damages in other parts of statute? Not practicing civil law, I know that it's really difficult, or I understand it's really difficult in Minnesota law to get exemplary damages. Is it the same standard under this statute in that it rarely happens?
Representative De La Forest.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, as I look around the room, I am about 50th on the list, I think, of experts with respect to how litigation in this area works. Reading the newspaper, if you will, you don't see many cases. I think there was one in South Washington County where I think there were some significant damages awarded, so I don't feel comfortable speaking with any specificity to how it actually works in litigation. I don't know. It's, you know, my rationale for it is for a deterrent effect, so hopefully nobody has to engage in litigation, and that the threat of some substantial penalties will force a government to take with seriousness Data Practices Act requests and their decision whether to release or not release data.
Senator Scheid?
Yeah, Madam Chair. A couple of things, and I'm going to admit I was distracted a bit ago, but I have a couple of questions about this. Let's see. My first one would have to do with responsible authority on lines 316 and 317. I'm wondering who that could be. I've not served on data practices before, but Senator Betzold kind of told me that generally this is about governmental entities and what they may or may not disclose. But if a government has a local government has a contract with someone, a private entity, I am assuming that would cover them. They would be the responsible authority, perhaps? I'm not sure. It would be other than a governmental unit. They'd be the agent or whatever of a governmental unit. So they could be affected by this as well.
Ms. Pontius, do you know if there's a definition of responsible authority in that? Okay.
Madam Chair, members, it's defined in Chapter 13.
It's the person.
Okay.
And it's kind of like the data practices manager, for lack of a better. That's kind of a short, within a government entity.
Okay.
So it wouldn't have an impact then on contracts? Well, it might. It could, I guess.
Madam Chair, Senator Shah, I mean, there's a general provision in the State Data Practices Act where if the government entity is using a contractor for various functions, they have to comply with Chapter 13.
So they're
sort of like an arm of the government entity for Chapter 13 purposes.
And then my other question is, I understand it's a matter of evidence and you're being able to prove it, but you already are entitled to damages sustained if you lost your business because of damage to your reputation by disclosure of some private information. I mean, a person already can recover damages. I understand this is to be exemplary. This is above and beyond your actual damages. I don't know if the violations are so egregious. I mean, I don't know how many of these situations have arisen where somebody's been destroyed, and then the governmental entity is already liable for those damages that you can prove. Can maybe somebody clarify for me how egregious a problem this is?
Representative Simon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me just give you one anecdote, and it's one that House members have heard me tell before, and Representative Dale Forrest alluded to it a moment ago. I had a client in my other job who was a state employee. Some people in this room may know who this person is or may remember reading about the story in the newspaper. But because of a willful violation by someone, a colleague of his in a state agency who basically didn't like him, information was leaked, which got out into the media, that claimed that he had child pornography on his state-issued laptop computer. That was not true. It ended up not being the case. There never was any child pornography. This guy endured what I can only describe as, just a barrage, where he had death threats at home. He had to resign from boards and commissions. His kids were getting, all sorts of trouble in school. I mean, his reputation is done. For the rest of his life, if you Google his name, you're going to get stories about him having child porn. That's it. You can't undo Google. I think that's one thing we know now. And this guy was just destroyed by it. And so we ended up settling the case. But that's one example. And I know we shouldn't let individual anecdotes only drive our policy making. But that's one example of what can happen. And I would just say that I think he can speak for himself, but I think what Representative De La Forest has said pretty consistently, at least since I've been here, is he wants to sort of move the needle a little bit. At the risk of putting you on the spot, Representative De La Forest, I've never heard you to say that this particular range that's in this provision is your sort of bottom line position. But the idea is that if we haven't raised it since, I think it's 1974, then maybe in the year 2008, it's time to move the needle. The other thing I would say, too, is I am sensitive to the concerns of some involved with local government. The League of Cities and others have talked to me about the fact that, for some small township somewhere, $1,000 is nothing to sneeze at. And maybe the idea there is to not raise the floor but raise the ceiling. That's something we could think about. And that if the needle is moved at all, it's on the upper end, not the lower end. Keep a very low floor or something like that. I think there are ways to accommodate the real concerns of entities that are so small that even a tiny penalty would hurt them.
Do we have someone here from the League of Cities? Just because we did not have this introduced as a bill, why don't we just, if you can limit your testimony to just 1 or 2 minutes, I think the Senate should hear both sides of the story before, not that we're going to make a final decision at this moment anyway, but Would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grundhofer, General Counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities. I guess I would offer two comments about the Section 3 adjustment. First, as was mentioned, there are already some pretty clear disincentives already built in the law that where you can collect actual damages and attorney's fees, which is a extraordinary remedy already above and beyond what you can usually get in a any kind of action. So it's already some significant disincentives in the law. Secondly, in response to Representative De La Forest's observation, I actually think the reality is that by increasing the upper end, you probably further discourage and promote the idea that when in doubt, you do not release, because the consequences of wrongfully releasing become even greater. So more and more, I think you're going to find that instead of promoting openness, you're going to actually create a greater disincentive to, or a greater incentive to try to not potentially violate the law. So I'd stand for questions.
Okay. Does anyone have a question for this witness? Representative Lesh?
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Grunhofer, I asked a question before regarding, I don't think anyone else was able to answer, regarding the general parameters of awards that have been given in these cases, if at all, and as Representative De La Forest stated, it's pretty rare and acts as a disincentive. But if and where there are awards, where do they land? And does the exemplary damages rubric for this section for public entities, is the standard the same as it is in other cases of law, such that it's very difficult to get?
Madam Chair, members, Mr. Representative Lesh, I frankly don't know of many cases at all that have actually addressed and awarded damages. The ones that have are generally situations where there have been large actual damage awards, where somebody's reputation was in fact damaged and they could show actual damages. So, and as far as exemplary damages versus punitive damages, I guess my view is it would be the same standard, but I haven't seen it play out in an actual piece of litigation yet.
Well, Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grunhofer, perhaps I can clarify. I do understand that, and that was my understanding, too, that exemplary and punitive are the same. And if I'm incorrect on that, maybe someone can correct me. But more so in the way of, I know that in other areas of law, as a general rule, exemplary damages in Minnesota are very difficult to attain, and if this just falls under that same category of the rules of civil procedure, and that there isn't a separate carve-out for public entities.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, that is true.
Mr.
Gunner? The one interesting observation about this particular section, though, is that the willful violation could be made by any particular government employee, regardless of who it is, but the unlike, for instance, tort claims where a punitive damage award is paid by the wrongdoer, under the way this is written, the exemplary damages isn't paid by the person who willfully violates the law. It's paid by the government entity, and that's, frankly, fairly unprecedented, where the government entity, which had nothing to do with somebody releasing the wrongfully releasing, gets to pay the consequence of that. So that's a big deal.
The follow-up comment I would make to that, it's Grunhofer, right?
Grunhofer,
okay. Is that the government entity, though, generally is setting the policies that employees are following and conducting the training and conducting the oversight. So, so that we do want to encourage government entities to take responsibility to make sure that the training and the policies in place are adequate so that this information is handled properly. I mean, you can't control those situations where someone has a grudge against someone else and, things happen. But I do think we want to take this area of the law very seriously in making sure that we're handling sensitive information correctly. Members, unless there are any more questions at this point, what I'm going to suggest, and thank you very much for your testimony, we appreciate it. I'm going to suggest that we move past this section and that we allow for some opportunity to come back and discuss it. Maybe among ourselves we can find that there is a little room to work something out that we'll, you know, we'll have to have some discussions about that. Okay, the next section that we should turn to then would be on page R41, section 5.12, which has to do with the Metropolitan Airport parking customers. And Representative Simon, do you know whose bill this was?
Yes, Madam Chair, thanks. This was, I think, Representative Hillstrom's bill. It was a standalone bill, is my understanding. Staff can correct me if I'm wrong about that. And the idea behind it, if that's what you're looking for, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. is that those in the audience here or elsewhere who know the system now at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, there's essentially a credit card check-in option when you're going into the parking ramp. You can, Representative Lilly knows it very well. You swipe your credit card before going to the parking ramp, and I think the idea was to keep that data non-public.
I've actually used that system, Representative Simon, and it works really well because you don't have to hang on to a ticket, and then when you leave again, you just put the same card back in there, and it automatically figures what your bill should be, and you even get a little discount for using it. But apparently, there's some ambiguity in the law about the protection related to that private information, and so we want to make sure that we, I think the purpose of this bill was to make sure that protection is given. And Representative Simon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just reminded by Mr. Gehring that Section 24 on R18 is the substantive provision. What we're looking at back on R4 is just a cross-reference. But for those looking for the actual substance, it's on page R18. But same rationale stands.
And if there are any questions on the Senate side, I do believe that I had the bill, and I introduced the bill on this provision on the Senate side, and we didn't take a position on it. I think we just ran out of time in terms of hearing it. So I'm going to recommend that we accept this provision. Does anyone have any other thoughts? Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just Representative Simon did cover it very well, and I just want to encourage support of the action you're proposing there, because I think it's one of those things that is clearly a common sense thing that we're doing up here. Here's an example, is that since it is public data, someone could find out the comings and goings of someone, or a thief even, or something, and figure out that so-and-so is out of town for 5 days or whatever, so, you know, develop some patterns or something, and so that would be rather unfortunate. So it's kind of a simple fix and makes a lot of sense.
Senator Limmer, then Senator Shaw.
Madam Chair, is these automated parking operations, are they only exclusive to the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, or are they found elsewhere in the state? And if we only isolate our focus on the airport facilities, does that mean if there's other facilities elsewhere in the state, are we not having any law that covers those? Do we know?
Do you know, Representative Lilly?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, my understanding is it's because it's a public place. It's a, you know, so it's different than the Mall of America. Well, I guess you don't pay for parking there. But so it's the nature of the beast being, the MAC properties. So it is, I don't think we can tie this to other sites. I can't think of another example in the state. I'm trying to think of some, but.
Senator Scheid, and then...
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. My memory tells me that we did something about this kind of data from a credit card with respect to retail consumers. So I think that the private sector already has some requirements about how long they have to clear data and prevent that from being...
Actually, Senator Scheid, that was my bill last session, but that was a little bit different. That was kind of between the banking industry and the retail industry.
Yes,
so that was a similar type of situation, but not quite the same.
No, and Madam Chair, I have no quarrel with doing this.
Okay, Representative Lesh.
I'll pass, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, You know, I'm not sure. It's an interesting question that was raised, whether there's a potential that this should be applicable in other situations. But I would only say that since this has been brought forward by the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, that we should adopt this. But it might be something that we'd want to revisit next session if there are potentially other situations and where we should broaden the language. But since we don't have that that information right now, my suggestion would be that we Senator Moir or Representative or Senator Limmer?
One question I did have. It refers to this information is classified under 473674. What is that classification? What would that be?
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, members, that's actually, again, if you look at Section 24 of the House language, which is on our
18.
18, is it? So basically, it makes it either non-public or private. It specifies what's included.
Madam Chair, has there been a motion to move this language? Is that what you're asking? I apologize.
Yes.
I've been out.
That's what I'm asking, Senator Moir. Would you like to move the language?
Madam Chair, I'm not... I'd like to sit with it for a little bit, if that's okay with you, until we go through the rest of the other provisions. And, Madam Chair, it's my understanding that, again, this was a bill, but it didn't get a hearing, right?
Because, right, but it was a bill.
Yeah, it was a bill. And was it because it's a late bill? It's just the Senate doesn't have a position on this, so I just want to make sure where we are and why that's the case.
Madam Chair, I think that it was introduced after we had our last data practices committee.
There's a late bill.
Okay, then moving on to Section 5.15 on still on page R4-1, which has to do with the health assessment survey prohibition. And this is something that my understanding, and I'll turn it over to whoever would like to speak on the House side, but my understanding is that what this relates to is we are all, as legislative members, covered under the type of insurance that allows us to go through a health assessment annually, I believe it is, and that if we comply with this, we get some reductions in, I think, you know, like from $10 to $5 for a copay. And so there's a little reward for engaging in something that's supposed to be good from a health prevention standpoint, and that there was some concern on the House side that this was considered to be a privacy invasion. Is this your provision, Representative De La Forest, or...
And, Madam Chair, I'm really not that radical. I know we just met. We had the penalties provision here for the release of information as well as the health assessment survey. Madam Chair, really the genesis of this is you're right. All of us know that during the open enrollment period, you can agree to take a health assessment survey that asks various questions about how you live and the way in which you live. And in exchange for that, you can get some type of modest reduction in your co-pays. Or you can choose not to take it, and I guess it can be argued one way or the other whether or not you suffer a penalty for not taking the survey or whether you get a benefit for taking the survey. And this really started in the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. I know, Senator Scheid, you and I have served for a number of years, and that appears to be the only place in the legislature where this issue has even been discussed. It became a House position, and members of the House, in a very bipartisan way, became concerned that these health assessment surveys were getting ahead of legislative oversight. And apparently, we've never had a bill with respect to, for example, the health assessment surveys regarding their content or who's conducting them. They've essentially been an affair that has been undertaken by the Department of Employee Relations. And so over time, to add some perspective to my Senate colleagues, on a bipartisan basis, the House grew increasingly frustrated. And I will be completely honest with the members of this conference committee. I offered this amendment on the floor as a discussion point. I didn't think it was going to pass. Now, I'm not saying I think it's bad legislation. I think it's good legislation. But when 75 of my colleagues, despite Representative Simon's entreaties otherwise, voted to support this...
I carry a lot of weight.
Representative Simon, you do with right. me. But 75 members of the House voted to adopt this position, and so I admit it is problematic in some respects to have a prohibition as it is articulated in conference committee right now. But by the same token, I think that the House has got a position that we're very frustrated by the lack of legislative oversight with these health assessment surveys that ask some very invasive questions. And as I said, in fact, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, Representative Rukavina and Hillstrom, I think are the most vocal supporters of my position. But Madam Chair, so that I lay my cards on the table. I understand the language as it's written certainly is problematic in some respects, but by the same token, I certainly want to speak on behalf of myself and other House members who are very, very frustrated by the current state of affairs with respect to these health assessment surveys.
Senator Moi.
Madam Chair, Representative De La Forest, the Senate will be more than willing to rescue you from those renegade mavericks who, you know, just went way too far on your amendment that was introduced for just discussion purposes.
Senator Schein.
Madam Chair, this may be just a difference of perspective. Representative Hillstrom and I have had a number of conversations about this. And I was upset with my health assessment survey two terms running, if you will, or 2 years running, when they asked me all kinds of questions, but not one thing would lead to the fact that I had cancer. And I was kind of taken back by that. I sounded like I was in pretty decent health, lose a little weight, and I'll be just fine. You know, and I just wish that were so. But, I mean, I am fine, but I didn't think that it was exactly probing enough. If you can come up with an estimate of a person who's in pretty good shape while they're undergoing chemotherapy for a stage 3 cancer, you aren't really asking the right questions, you know? So, at least, you know, I don't have it now, but I thought it wasn't thorough enough, I guess. And so, and some people think it's too invasive. So, I suppose maybe it matters if you've got cancer or not. I don't know, but I thought that was pretty laughable in a way. You know, that it didn't bother. It didn't care about that part of my health. It was just interested in the other things. I know. I think it's actually used, though. I mean, I think it's to try to improve our behavior with respect to our own health, and I don't think that's a bad thing. On the other hand, if you feel that people are getting information out of you that you're not comfortable sharing, or that a person might be in that position, I suppose, then they could just opt out at that point. I'm not sure they make you answer all the questions to get your $5 off. You know, that's probably that's the incentive for people to participate. But I think probably overall it's a good thing to do. They just need to be more thorough.
Representative Hortman, did you have a comment?
Yeah, well, I think the point of these things is supposed to be that they somehow save us money because mm-hmm. they induce healthier behavior. But until we have some data that suggests they generate some results, to me it seems like kind of a meaningless exercise. I did it, too, to try to save whatever money I could save from the survey, but I have to say I'm probably one of those renegade voters who voted with Representative De La Forest because I thought it didn't amount to much, and this is probably an issue that the health care committees camped out all summer about, whether answering these surveys actually can save people money. But as an employer, which we are here at the state, we should know it's saving us money before we're asking our employees to go through it.
I just would, Representative Portman, and I'll come back to you, Representative Lesh, but I was actually really surprised, but actually I was kind of delighted to see this in the bill, only because I did spend a lot of time, not that I agree, I'll just try to be clear, that I really don't support your position here because
personally, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why, because it's voluntary, and I don't think it is a penalty. We weren't adding a penalty. We're allowing someone to do something voluntary that certainly can't hurt, and perhaps can help. And people don't have to do this. They're not going to be penalized by it. They're more rewarded if they do decide to do it. And so that's why I look at this a little bit differently. But the reason I said I thought I was kind of delighted to see this in here is because I have spent a lot of time since last session. I sat on three different healthcare reform committees, and I have some concerns myself personally about the healthcare reform direction that we are going right now. And we are going a lot farther down the road of sort of a pay-for-performance, expecting people to do a lot of report carding and providing a lot of people's medical information to be reviewed, to be outcome-oriented. I mean, we're going in a much bigger way than this, down that direction and down that road. And if there are concerns about whether it's a good direction to go, and whether we should be spending a lot of administrative costs going down that direction without knowing whether it's really going to lead to cost savings, then this is such an innocuous little piece compared to that it surprised me that the House would be so in favor of this amendment and yet go the other direction on the healthcare reform vote. So that's why I was interested when I saw this. And that's, again, that's my perspective, but I have spent a lot of time looking and thinking about healthcare reform issues, and so it seemed to me to be a little sort of inconsistent, those two positions. But anyway, Senator Moi.
Well, now that you've been talking about healthcare, Madam Chair, does this even relate to data practices?
Well, Madam Chair, that's what I was going to say. I mean, if to really get into this, and I think Representative De La Forest was honest about saying he put this out there for discussion purposes, I don't think we could do justice to the discussion of this amendment without hours of testimony. And, you know, and really it's more of a healthcare issue that should go through healthcare committees rather than to have that kind of policy discussion in data practices. So,
thank you, Madam
Lesch.
Chair. Well, it won't surprise you to know that I think we can do justice to it. I am apparently one of those renegades, Senator Moore, also who voted with Representative
always
De La Forest on it. I know.
You're always
you know you love it, though. I think, you know, one of the concerns is, and a lot of people in the House, this is really one of those issues that crosses party lines, because it's a basic philosophical difference between, are we going to take a big brother approach to telling everyone how they need to behave in order to be healthy, or are we going to let people go into their doctors on their own and say, what do I need to do to be healthier? And these assessments, I took one once, I think I recall, and had everything from how do you drive to do you have a gun in your house to, and they put all these things together and they say, okay, well, here's where you fall on the graph, get rid of this, this, and this, and, you know, you're going to live past 53 or something like that. And I think a lot of people do not think of healthcare as being that kind of thing. I get to make my own decisions about how I'm going to live my life, and I get to pay the consequences for that on my own. I know I'm sounding like a radical. But I thought this may be more palatable, perhaps, for you, Senator Moi. This language, along the lines of a health insurance company may not offer monetary incentives, rather than outright prohibit, perhaps may not offer monetary incentives to public employees for the purpose of assessing the health of the individual or collective group. Now, there's nothing in there about survey, because I struck the word survey and added that language in, but it wouldn't outright preclude these, but it would take away monetary incentive, which I think would be a little more fair.
Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, that's got nothing to do with the bill, if you go that direction. Surveys arguably might have something with data practices. If it becomes monetary incentive for health care, you know, what's it doing the data practices of the bill?
And Representative Lesch, I guess also the other thing I would say is that all the private insurance companies and HMOs I'm aware of, shouldn't say all, but very many of them are doing this. And so the bigger policy question about, you know, are we going to allow this or not, really, I would have to agree, is more of a healthcare issue. And I appreciate your concerns, but I don't know that we can really do justice to all the questions that were raised. here in data practices. Why don't we, this is one we're not going to get through easily, so why don't we set this one aside for now, too, and just move to the next.
Madam Chair, I don't have any more language in the bill.
Does that mean it's going to go more quickly for now? Okay. The next thing, we're still on page R4-1, and that's a Senate provision, data sharing between the Department of Education and Office of Higher Education. And I, this is the one that Representative Simon has the same language in a standalone bill, same or similar. And I was the author of this bill. This is something that the commissioners, both commissioners, requested. And it sounds like we've had hearings on both sides. So.
Did the bill fail in the House?
Representative Simon?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, no, it's on the General Register right now in the House as a standalone bill.
So the only difference is that we have it in our omnibus bill, apparent data practices bill, apparently, and they're taking a different route on the House side. Senator Benzel?
Madam Chair, as Ms. Pontius mentioned, it's also in the higher ed article of the omnibus bill, the budget omnibus bill. I believe it's in K-12 as well, too. It's a couple of places.
Okay. Senator Betzel, would you like to make a motion on this one?
Well, I'd like to know where it's going to wind up. You know, I mean, you know, I mean, if we take it out of here and they take it out of there, it might not never pass. You know, for something that's in so many places. Is the anticipation we're going to be able to finish today, or are we still going to be? Because as we speak, I'm on the other conference committee, and they're talking about the higher ed article right now. So I'm not sure who's moving what over there. So.
Well, I do think we've gone through two out of about four of the longer discussions, so maybe we can whip through some of these things quickly.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll move we adopt Section 3 since, you know, it's literally past the body a couple of places. If down the road we, you know, it passes in one place, we can take it out of the other, but I'll move that we adopt it. So.
Okay. Senator Betzold has moved that we adopt the Senate language in Section 3. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Then moving on to page R5, we have a one-word difference that may have some significance. Ms. Pontius, can you give us some more detail about that? On line 5.30, the House language includes the phrase investigative process, which is not in the Senate language.
Madam Chair, members, yes, that's correct. And this is the Civil Investigative Data Statute, which currently allows the confidential data to be released to aid the law enforcement process, and this would also include the investigative process. Otherwise, the language is identical, the two bills.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering whether you might entertain some brief testimony from Ms. Breyer-Kopensky to talk about the rationale for this particular provision. I think she's prepared to, in terms of explaining why the change.
Sure. And before we do that, I just wanted to ask Ms. Pontius, if you recall, did we actually, Ms. Breyer-Kopensky can tell us, did we consider that language on the Senate side, or was this just added as an amendment on the House side and wasn't discussed on the Senate side?
Madam Chair and members, Senator Betzel carried this bill, and it was laid over in Data Practices Subcommittee.
Oh, it was part of that.
It was a part of a larger bill to do a variety of things to have better clarity around civil investigative and licensing data and how the two sections intertwine. This particular language about investigative process, in civil investigative data, once you call it civil investigative data, it's confidential. So even though it's about you, even though I'm investigating Representative Simon, I can't share data with him. So when I want to go to interview either him or witnesses, hypothetically, I can't even tell them what I'm investigating you for. So at some point, you do have to be able to share data with both witnesses and the subjects so that they can adequately either defend themselves or provide you information. So that's the rationale for the language. And the other pieces of this, these are the pieces that of the variety of people who have testified against the bill that they were all comfortable with. So what you've got is really a very pared-down list of both some substantive changes as well as technical changes that the AG's office, the League of Minnesota Cities, AMC, variety of private attorneys, the League of Legal Services, a variety of stakeholders we're all comfortable with. And Madam Chair, if you'd like me to go into more detail about the other sections, or if you just wanted to deal with what was in Section 7 on the House language, that's just fine.
Well, Senator, I'll get you in just a minute, Senator Limmer, but this was apparently then part of the big bill that we talked about at some length and laid on the table, and the concern as the language was originally brought forward was that it was going to be too easy to categorize something as investigative data more or less indefinitely and then prevent the public from having access to that information. And I think we used the example of the possibility of potentially an investigation, an internal investigation related to a bridge and what might have caused it to fall down, for example, and not releasing that information to the public because there could potentially be other types of similar situations in the future, and so it could be categorized as something that would be protected to prevent because it could be an issue in future litigation. And I don't think we want to go down that path. I think we made it pretty clear, on the Senate side at least, that we don't want to make it more difficult for the public to access investigative information than it presently is.
And Madam Chair, on the Senate and members, what you really heard on the Senate side in testimony was really concerns about the existing discretion under civil investigative data that exists. The proposal wasn't doing anything to curtail or trim the discretion, but what you heard was really concerns that people have about the law that exists right now. And this proposal wasn't at that time and isn't now doing anything to change that discretion. When a government entity is faced with litigation, they have the ability to declare data to be civil investigative data. And then there's a structure for when it becomes inactive so that people can have it again. But what you really heard was concerns about people that is either anecdotal information on that is sometimes overused and that people wanted to continue to work over the interim, and Representative Simon is interested in doing that to figure out how can we put tighter parameters around the discretion that exists right now.
And so, Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, the language that is in the bill that you described as non-controversial, the changes that this makes as compared to what we talked about in the hearing, can you differentiate that?
Madam Chair and members, I think the largest thing when you first saw it on the Senate side was on 1341, which is the licensing data. Right now, that licensing data just applies to when I'm a teacher and I'm going to go apply as an individual human being to get my teaching license, and it didn't cover businesses. So there was a disconnect where data about certain people who get licenses was protected, but if I was a sole proprietor of a business, I wouldn't get protection. And what the proposal was really to say, you know what? People who get licenses should be entitled to some of the same protections. And that was where you were correct in that it was a dramatic policy shift to start seeing less differences between businesses and human beings. And that was, I think, what you're remembering was the biggest policy discussion of whether or not we should start to go down the road of, well, if I'm in a partnership with my husband and we have a business license and then there's a complaint about us, should everything be public all the time, or should I get the same protection that a teacher would get or someone else would get when someone makes a complaint about them, when you don't know if it's true at that point or not?
Senator Limmer, did you have a question?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm trying to get a little more definition of when this would occur. Is this investigative process during you're collecting data? Data is usually collected to share with others sometime down the path. And would this be on give me a circumstance of when an investigative process would occur so I have a little perspective.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, perfect example. I get a complaint about one of my employees. I start an employee investigation. All of the data about that complaint, I go to my chief attorney and they say, yes, this is a civil investigation. You know, either you might want to, kind of sue your employee or someone may sue you that kind of thing. So I start gathering data, and then I start to interview witnesses. You know, did you see Katie yesterday? Did she have a big bag of money that she was walking out the door with? Those are the kinds of things you want to be able to interview witnesses to be able to gather evidence. And at some point, you want to be able to share with Katie, here's what the complaint says. This is the kind of, you know, did you do these things, didn't you? Because right now, data practices doesn't really build in, at some point, due process. The ability for someone to defend themselves needs to really trump data practices, and you need to be able to share data to either have a good investigation or to figure out, you know, how, what's the real facts of the situation.
Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer.
So we probably would agree that some of this information could be potentially, well, personal, perhaps damaging to an individual. We're putting it into this proposal as investigative process to be added to this. But once we start collecting data, you had even said that it does somewhere we cross the line and due process has to come in to make this fair. But we don't include due process in this proposal. We just add investigative process. So when does the due process come in, and are we overstepping the opportunity here if we don't put a due process element in with this language?
Ms. Meyer-Kopensky?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, very good question. That was in the language that you initially saw on the Senate side, and a number of people asked for the Attorney General's office to comment on the various pieces and what they were comfortable with. They were not comfortable with adding the due process rights to the subject. They were more comfortable with the language of it aiding the investigative process as an umbrella to include both of those pieces. So I removed it specifically at the concern of the Attorney General's office.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, one of the things I did before I ran for office was investigations for private employers. And so when an employee, for example, would complain they weren't getting a reasonable accommodation, and then you do an investigation, this to me looks like it parallels the situation for a private lawyer for a company, which is everything you're doing in that investigation is attorney-client work product privilege. But you do want to waive the privilege to an extent in some of your interviews so that you can get better information to help you in your investigation, whether it's finding out whether somebody was provided reasonable accommodations or did sexual harassment occur or did somebody steal money from the company. But you do waive the right that you have to keep that information confidential to a limited extent to get better information. I think what the state is asking for here, it sounds like, is that same kind of ability to waive the privilege in that situation. But since we have a data practices issue and an attorney-client work product issue, they need us to give them permission to share that kind of information. It sounds very practical to me.
Sir, moi?
Madam Chair, I think I'm beginning to get the need for the language for the investigative process. But I actually want to ask Ms. Byer-Kopensky about the current law that talks about law enforcement process. This is a civil action. And when we talk about investigative process, I'm assuming that's a civil investigative process. Does law enforcement process ever come into play in a civil action or in a civil investigative process? Why would we need what's in current law?
Ms. Byer-Kopensky?
Madam Chair and Senator Moi, what I understand it to be is at some point you conduct an investigation and it's not just someone violated your, you know, in an employee situation. At some point it looks like someone has done something criminal and you want to be able to share that with law enforcement as well. So at some point a variety of the complaints that someone, a government entity, might receive might really rise to the level of a criminal action where you do want to have the ability to share it with law enforcement.
Madam Senator Moi,
Chair Ms. Byer-Kopensky, but at that point you are giving the information up to the law enforcement then to come in and do the investigation?
Ms. Byer-Kopensky?
Madam Chair, oftentimes either the investigation can then take that criminal turn or you can be having two investigations going side by side. And it depends. Some go both ways.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed that this area is focused on a government entity being the one that would foster the investigative process. So it's not a private firm. It's not a private company investigating losses. It's a government action on an individual that happens to be, what, an employee perhaps, most likely. And I feel a little uncomfortable recognizing an investigative process under this protection without recognizing due process rights, especially pointing out the fact that it's the government entity that's doing the investigating. And, you know, when a government does certain action toward a citizen, we trigger certain civil liberties that come in, and you have to allow that civil liberty to be recognized to balance the accusations of the government. So am I missing something by suggesting so bold that we have due process rights for the individual in this case?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I completely agree with you. And what I've tried to do here is be respectful of the feedback and the testimony that I've heard both in the House and the Senate, and removing the pieces that people found objectionable. But certainly the original bill had language about due process rights. I, you know, thought it was good language to include. I think at some point data practices, both in civil investigations and personnel data, have to get to that point of acknowledging due process rights.
Madam Chair, do we have a default position somewhere that there's some due process that we ultimately will, for the individual to rely on?
Senator Limmer, if I can recall the context of that discussion, without putting all the language in the bill back into in front of us again, there was certainly the objection, it wasn't to due process rights per se being recognized. It had more to do with the context of the language as it was being used in the bill and perhaps some confusion. So what I would suggest is, you know, certainly we can talk about other things related to this if people have questions, but maybe what we should do, since it looks as though we're probably not going to get through the whole bill today anyway, is go back and give you the opportunity to look at that language and maybe visit with Ms. Beyer-Kopinski and see if the rest of this is something the committee wants to adopt. We could maybe revisit that language in the context of just this provision. Would that be satisfactory to you? Because otherwise, I mean, so that we know what we're talking about rather than spending too much more time on it right now. Senator Scheid?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm concerned because I don't see anything here that leads this to criminal. It's totally civil. That's the heading of the whole chapter here. At 13.39 is civil investigation. And I don't see how what was said about this often leading to a criminal. I'm missing that connection.
I'm just thinking, Senator Scheid, and again, I'm not quite sure how this goes with investigative process, but let's just say that someone makes an accusation that that there's been a sexual assault in an employment setting, and an investigation begins, and
a civil investigation, pending civil action,
and it turns out that it should be considered for criminal charges, maybe as a rape or a sexual assault. And so, is that the type of situation, Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, where you'd be sharing that information, or have the latitude to share the information so that it could be investigated from a criminal standpoint as well?
And Madam Chair and members, the whole discretion right now is that you really can share civil investigative data with anyone if it's going to aid the law enforcement process, promote public health, safety, or dispel widespread rumor and unrest. So what? Imagine if I am the Department of Health and I get a complaint from someone saying, I have seen someone dumping unauthorized chemicals into the gutters. You know, something huge where you just go, you know what, not only do I need to do an investigation about that, I need to let public health know, I need to let law enforcement know, I need some immediate action. Or I get a complaint of, I just saw, you know, kids in a health house and it looks like it's a meth house and you regulate meth. And there are very instances where you might get a complaint that just rises to the level where it's not just, you know, I think I'll take away your license to teach, where it's so egregious that you need to either share it with the general public. You know what? You might want to stay away from this block of Minneapolis for the next, you know. There are just some of those instances, and the law allows for the government who decided this was data that would have otherwise been public. You decided you were going to classify it as confidential because of a civil investigation, and at some point you decide, you know what? Me putting together my case is not as important as protecting the public from something, so that you still have this ability to share. And I wanted to follow up on something that Representative Portman said, too, is oftentimes we don't have always attorneys doing these investigations, so it's not just you're waiving your attorney-client privilege. You've got just normal government employees who do these investigations, so that's why you want that kind of authority to be able to share.
Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, though, the question I have about this is the person who's conducting the investigation, the way we had the law before, the sharing of information is going to go to some third party, or it's measured by some third party standard for public safety or to aid law enforcement, because otherwise this is classified or confidential information, so that if they talk to a witness or whatever, they have an obligation to keep that information confidential. The investigative process is really just kind of talking about their own process, isn't it, in the context of doing their investigation? So isn't it kind of almost negating the confidentiality that you'd be putting there in the first place? Because it's basically just saying, well, it's only confidential to the extent that I want to keep it confidential, because if it's going to help me out in the investigation, then it's not confidential. And so so that's quite a shift in policy, don't you think?
Madam Chair, members, I think what this recognizes is this is how an investigation has to happen now. And that's how also the U.S. Constitution, at some point due process comes in and you have to share. It just recognizes that I can't really do an investigation without sharing something with someone. And I think this is just recognizes that that happens now, and that there's no way to do an investigation that doesn't involve interviewing witnesses and sharing with the person that supposedly did something. I just don't know how else you can do it. So I think it happens now, and this just recognizes that that kind of a sharing is okay.
Any other questions? Since this was Senator Moi.
Madam Chair, I'm satisfied with Ms. Kopinski's response to that. I'm still a little bit concerned about law enforcement process, but that's not that's current law, and I'll think that through a little bit to see whether or not we revisit that next year. But if nobody has any objections, I'd like to move Section 7 of the House language.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
In light of the discussion, I had an amendment that on this particular area. I'm not sure if Council is ready with it or not right now, but maybe Council could tell me if the amendment is ready.
While you're working on an amendment, Mr. Neumeister has asked to testify, and we're going to take just very briefly some testimony from Mr. Neumeister on this issue.
Well, Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I am an open government and privacy advocate, and my question is, Madam Chair, is are we just talking about investigative processes, or are we going to talk about the whole section at this point? That's why.
With respect to licensing?
Right. I mean, because they're both interrelated in a way, because right now, the way it's set up, 1341 is separate, that deals with licenses. 1339 does things with investigative data, and if you go look through the rest of the civil investigative data proposals, it intersyncs both of them. And also, there are issues of what comes into play as to when data is released, when it is not, with two different standards. So, and I do have some concerns about the investigative process. So, as Madam Chair and members of the Conference Committee, as you may know, these are things that are interrelated. And when you do one thing to another, it can have an impact on something else. So, I would suggest that what you might want to do is take together those two sections, talk about civil investigative data, and then let folks testify, because that's where I think you'll get the greater picture and the better worth of the testimony.
Senator Ma, your motion, does that include the entire... What was your motion in reference to?
Just Section 7, Madam Chair.
Okay, so why don't we limit your testimony at this point to just any comments you might have just on Section 7, which has to do with the investigative data.
Investigative process, I do not know what that means. I think you got to remember is that under 1339, when folks collect information about this, it's a pot of information. It could be allegations. It could be based some things based on facts and all that. And if you look under also in Subdivision 2, this is the kind of information that can be released to almost anybody at any purpose for any public entity that goes by 1339. So one of the concerns I have is that there are allegations about someone. There's an inactive file. And then someone believes that they think, oh, there's a file on such and such in such and such department in such and such entity, and then they ask for that information. And then that information is then shared then with that entity, whatever that is. And that's, I think, a big hole in whatever investigative process is. If the investigative process is to allow information to be shared for due process, blah, 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 then maybe put that in there. But then I'm trying to think for myself over the last 30 years that this has been a law. The Constitution guarantees due process. I think folks have probably been able to get their data that they need to assert their case. So I don't know. All I know is that then this, I think, creates more issues. And then in the other part, in Section 8, or on the next page on RSEC 1, and with a memo I shared with you, Madam Chair, and some other members, that when you start looking at what is the standard of how investigative data is released, do you go by the 1339 standard? Or do you go by the 1341 standard, Subdivision 6, which presents a higher standard? There are many apples, many oranges, many eggs in here, Madam Chair. So I just share that real quick perspective in that regards.
Okay. Ms. Beyer-Kopensky, is there a definition of investigative process anywhere that would be...
Madam Chair, no, we were going with the plain meaning. And we did intend it to be the investigative process of the government entity conducting the civil investigation.
Okay. Well, it may be that we need to do some work on that language.
Madam Chair, would you like me to withdraw my motion?
Senator Moore, would you consider withdrawing
your... I will draw my motion.
Perhaps we can do a little work on the language to address some of Mr. Neumeister's concerns and come back to this. Now that we have all had an introduction to it, we have a better idea what this is about, kind of reminded ourselves of some of the discussion we had earlier in committee. Is there anything... We have someone else at the table. I'm going to limit, though, your testimony if you can be extremely brief, like a minute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I'm Rebecca Hamblin with Education Minnesota. Listening to the representative from the Department of Administration was informative for me because that made it sound like something that, as an attorney representing members at Education Minnesota, we would like. We get frustrated by due process issues, et cetera. However, the language as it's written, some of the questions that have been raised, whose investigative process is it? Apparently, it's the government entities, but that's not clear. For whom is it being provided? Again, so whose data, for whom is it provided? It just, to me, is very vague and broad, and I think it needs some work before, certainly speaking for our organization, we'd be comfortable seeing this amendment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I think what we'll do then, Ms. Beyer-Kopensky, thank you very much. You've also touched on what's on the next page with respect to licensing. Mr. Neumeister, I know, has some concerns, and he shared a memo with me. I wonder whether, just to kind of save some time, if we can move past that, and you and Mr. Neumeister could perhaps talk, and if you could attempt to address some of the questions he has. Rather than having open-ended questions asked during this conference committee, perhaps you can answer some of those questions in a way that will be enlightening for us, and we can come back to that. Or if there isn't an answer, and you agree that it could perhaps be answered with a little more language, if you could try to narrow the focus for us, I think that would be helpful.
Madam Chair and members, Mr. Neumeister and I spoke before the hearing, and I think we just have a fundamental disagreement. I believe that adding a narrower definition of license in Section 9, where it is a narrower definition tied to an occupation that you are required to have, means that less data is being protected, so that it's clear that we don't mean your recreational DNR fishing license, that it's really only those, however you call it, if it's called a license or whatever it's called, that you have to engage in business or an occupation, that those are the ones we're talking about. Because in the past, there's been confusion. If I have some other thing, you know, that an agency might say, I'd like you to sign up for this. Here's a registration. But, you know, you can do it and it's voluntary versus those things that are mandatory. And I think a broader, tighter definition protects less data. So I think Mr. Neumeister and I just fundamentally disagree. He's just concerned about what other data might be protected according to this. And I just think it's a narrower and tighter definition, and that's a better outcome and a clearer answer for government to apply so that they cannot apply it more broadly than that.
So, Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, the decision for this conference committee to make then between the two positions, can you just lay that out very clearly for the members? And maybe the easiest thing to do is just for us to make that choice then.
Madam Chair and members, I think that the choice is the current language is not very clear as to what kinds of licenses are covered. So this
covered in Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, can you just elaborate?
Yep.
Covered
okay.
As
the current language just says that defines a licensing agency and gives them statutory authority to issue professional or other types of licenses, and then exempts human services. So that's all we're left with. It's just an agency, a state agency, who has the authority to issue licenses of some kind. So what we do is take that and then focus it on those licenses or things that you need to engage in occupation, trade, or business. So instead of your larger license, you know, for your DNR fishing license or your DNR, you know, permit to fish, that you have then just these ones for attorneys. You know, we need a license to practice law. That's really clear. You can't do it without it. You need a license to practice medicine, to be a nurse, to be a teacher. We wanted to focus in on those kinds of licenses and not some other kinds of things that might be extra. I can drive a car without having a commercial driver's license. I can, you know, drive a bakery truck and probably don't have to have a commercial driver's license. To make that distinction, ma'am, I think.
And so the question is, that information that you have is classified as private data, correct?
Madam Chair, the current statute is, yes, licensed data is private data with certain exceptions.
And so anything that is non-licensed data then, so if I want to buy a deer hunting license or get a driver's license, then that information is classified not as private data but as
public data.
Public
under
the data.
Presumption, ma'am. Yes.
Okay. And so the difference between your position and Mr. Neumeister's position is, Mr. Neumeister, can you just quickly tell us the difference from your point of view so that we just understand very clearly the choice we're making here?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I think it's very important to realize 1341 has always been for professional boards or professional type things. It has not been for fishing licenses. It has not been for driver's license. And that's what opinions and, you know, what folks have said constantly for all the years. Now, with the proposed language where you talk about permits, credentials, and registrations, going on the North Star site in general, I put each of those three terms in there, and there's thousands of permits, thousands of credentials, thousands of registrations. Now, I'm sure that it's probably in the hundreds that state entities do permits, registration, and credentials, which is separate than license. So when you are now expanding the definition of license in this proposal to those three areas, I don't know what that means in other parts of the law. I do believe, though, that the proposal as language I, Madam Chair, members of the conference committee, there are some things in this bill that are good, but as time goes on and it's whittled down, there's other issues coming into play that folks did not look at until now they're coming into proposal. I think something would be good to do something similar. License means, and take out certification, registration, or permit that involves, because the language on 617 does very much narrow it, for an individual to engage in an occupation, trade, or business regulated by law. One of the other concerns I have is that I am licensed to be a pesticide person, but now I have to get a permit to do my occupation to do something. I don't know out there what permit I need. I'm already licensed, but now a permit I need, how that will that become? What kind of data in that permit would become less public or more public? And those are the issues and the tie-ins that, Madam Chair, and members of the conference committee, this is like a web. And the issue is they all intersect. And if you do one thing, there's going to be impact on the other. So, Madam Chair, in summary, that is my point on this point.
Mr. Neumeister and Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, I think you just kind of made my point that I started to say before we had this conversation, which is you raise those questions, but they're not answered. And so I'd really appreciate it if the two of you could talk a little bit and we can come back to this to say what are the answers to some of those questions that Mr. Neumeister has so that we can clearly understand the policy choice that we're making here without having a long, long conversation about this. Mr. Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, we had this discussion before, and, I think that it's vague within the statute. Mr. Neumeister doesn't think it's vague. I think it is vague. I mean, the current law talks about other types of licenses. So I think that the language that is being proposed is more specific than that was to the current law, and I'm comfortable with it. I don't know that just having Ms. Karpinski talk to Mr. Neumeister, as we've been discussing for the last couple of months, is going to accomplish anything further. So we're the ones who have to make the decision here, if either we're comfortable with this or we're not. And as I say, with my bills, I'm comfortable with it. So I don't need two other people to go cut a deal when that's our job to do.
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair and members of the conference committee, I think I did offer at least a suggestion. I think to narrow it, take out the permits and those kinds of things, and just go to the occupational language. That also, as a matter of record, Mark Anvinson, who was here earlier on a number of issues as it relates to 1341, at least he told me that he has similar concerns about these sections, and he deeply regrets that he was not able to be here because he had a court date at 3:00, and he will communicate his concerns with you. I just also want to share that it's not just the Rich Neumeister, but there's other folks too.
Okay. Well, I think thank you very much both for your testimony. I think what we'll do is I'd feel more comfortable. Senator Betzel, sounds like you're ready to move the language or ready to accept the language, but I'm just going to suggest that maybe we can just come back to this and make our own decision, perhaps have a little discussion of it behind the scenes, make sure everyone's comfortable with it before we vote on it. So then, moving on to page R7-1, data on a public body applicants. Another issue that's been somewhat controversial. It seems like we have quite a few of them in the bill this year. This is a House provision, and so I'm going to turn it over to Representative Simon to discuss this.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think I can explain this, at least in concept. The idea here was, frankly, to counteract something that the Commissioner administration did during the interim, which was issue some kind of interim ruling or order with respect to people who are on public boards or commissions. And the interim order basically said that they did not have to provide an address or a phone number or an email address at which the public could get a hold of them. And our strong feeling in the House, I think, is that if you step forward to volunteer to do something in the public arena, particularly when you're on a decision-making body, that it's not unreasonable to expect that the public has some way to weigh in and get a hold of you. And that doesn't have to be a home address, because there are understandable security concerns. It doesn't have to be a home email. It doesn't have to be a home telephone number, but there ought to be some way. And so we did this language here, and I understand, Madam Chair, before we get too far down the road, that Mr. Gehring and Ms. Pontius have crafted an amendment that might allay some of the fears. So before we get into potential fears, I think we might want to do that. And that was the one, let's see here. Oh, this is, okay, should we just... being passed around. I'll just describe it briefly. Well, I think staff can describe the particulars, but the idea here is we are sensitive to the fact that in different areas of the state, for example, there might not be the, ready access to email or the use of email. And so instead of requiring all three, a designated mailing address, doesn't have to be the home address, but it's a designated mailing address, a designated phone number, and an email account, we decided to say that you've got to have the address. I think that's what the amendment says. You've got to have some sort of address. It can be a P.O. box. It can be the unit of government that was the appointing authority. And then you must have one or the other of a phone number or an email address if one is issued. And we heard anecdotally, at least, about some units of government that issue to people on boards, commissions, and the like, issue them a government-sponsored, city-sponsored, county-sponsored email address, but then that person chooses not to make it available to the public. So I don't know if staff want to describe anything that I haven't covered or anything I have in more detail.
And Representative Simon, just to kind of, again, to kind of speed things up here, I should say that I have discussed this with Mr. Neumeister, and I think his position would be that he'd rather have the actual home address be available, because his concern in a note that he sent around is that people be aware of where someone lives who serves on one of these public boards, so that we don't have everyone from one geographic area of town, for example. So I think his position was for more disclosure. Obviously, the commissioner's opinion was, you know, for no disclosure. And I think with the amendment that Representative Simon is offering, if this amendment is accepted, it would be more of a middle ground position. Senator Lemmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the approach on trying to get to a middle ground on this, but could we maybe be inadvertently disqualifying a number of people from being on boards if, let's say, they were low income and they couldn't afford a computer with an email address, or for that matter, maybe even a telephone? I was a loan officer for a number of years, and you'd be surprised how many people don't even have a telephone. And if we didn't have a phone or electronic means to get a hold of them by email, Could we possibly be disqualifying an individual from being a board member on one of these panels?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lemmer, I don't think so, and I'm sensitive to that concern. I'm glad you raised it. I don't think so, because this just says that they have to have a telephone number at which they can be reached, which I know of cases where, for example, a number of school board members I've worked at have a voicemail box at the school district. But don't make public their home phone. So I think even someone who didn't have a home telephone would still be, in this scenario, afforded, for example, a voicemail box or something of the kind where someone could get a hold of them. And I personally wouldn't even matter, wouldn't care so much if the telephone number that was disclosed wasn't personal to them, but it was the XYZ department at Hennepin County. If you want to get a hold of Commissioner Jones or Board Member Jones, just call this department and leave an old-fashioned pink slip message for them. I don't think it has to be a voicemail. It doesn't have to be their home. I think the idea here, and I'm sensitive to what you're raising, I think I'm speaking for the House conferees generally, and the House position is that if you step forward and volunteer for something public, especially if it's a decision-making body, Joe Q. Public and Jane Doe Public have a right to weigh in and get to you somehow. And so it doesn't have to be a home phone. That's the bottom line. It can even be a department number, I would suppose, at a government office.
Senator Shide?
I don't know if I want to step into this, but I have really strong feelings about people who are going to volunteer to be on my city's Human Rights Commission or Planning Commission or running for city council or state representative or state senator, that I have a right to know where they live. I think, you know, Senator Betzold told me that when he was first elected, he represented seven cities.
Seven suburbs, right.
And he called all of each of them to get the names.
He went down there personally.
He went personally to get the names and addresses or phone numbers of the various city council members. And there was only one city where he couldn't get that. It's where the mayor was Jesse Ventura, my city. Yes, our city.
Big surprise.
You know, and in fact, it was an issue. Because for quite a while, he didn't live in that house. In fact, he didn't live in that city. Now, the city horribly botched that investigation, but the point is, the citizenry has a right to know where people live. And frankly, if they live there. Because that was the craziness of that was that ultimately he didn't live there. It bothers me that these things aren't known. And so maybe I just come from too old a school where it wasn't an issue. I understand the potential problems for people, but I think the public interest outweighs the need to keep this information private.
Senator Scheid, I appreciate that testimony, and I think, you know, the original House language then would be more to your liking and probably Senator Betzold's liking.
I don't know.
I think the policy consideration for us today is whether some of the concerns were not with respect to elected official positions, but for smaller volunteer boards. Where people are not being, you know, paid anything, they're donating time, and they have some concerns, maybe that are safety related or privacy related, and whether we want to give any level of protection or consideration to people on those boards, or whether the public interest in knowing where they reside outweighs those concerns, and I guess that's the concern for the decision for us to make. And I don't really think, I don't know that we need any testimony on this unless anyone wants it, but I mean, I think we do understand what the policy issue is. Well, Mr. Neumeister, very briefly, unless it's something different than what we're...
Yeah, Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. There are some policy differences and different approaches that you can do. Now, Madam Chair, the issue is the definition of what a public body is in the House language, which is very broad or very limited, because there have been court cases and there have been opinions on that. So that's the issue. That's one issue. Number two, what this does in relationship to the open appointments process, because here you are, you're doing a law. Some of the votes that you did yesterday on confirmation on the Senate side, a lot of those are appointed to some of the state boards, at least anyways. Thirdly, this involves hundreds of boards, commissions that have impact on individual lives in all communities. The geographic diversity is very important. What you ever want to call it, you want to make sure. For me, I was a low-income person. I was raised in McDonough Housing Projects for 8 years. I was in low-income housing in a lot of ways. I might be called the other guy on the other side of the tracks. But I'm someone I want to make sure where address geographically can also depend on like income or whatever. So on planning commissions and all that, you want to have all that available to the public. And if you take a look at the history and why we're here of the temporary classification based on the MPCA request, because a lot of citizens wanted information to find out who was sitting on the Creative Climate Board that Perpich had. Or not Perpich, I'm thinking too long.
Oh my goodness.
Palenty. Palenty had. And so what happened, they go to the commissioner's office, it's public, but then they do a temporary classification and then brought that. Now, it's very broad. It deals with public scrutiny, accountability, where people live, you want to know. But it's also to be able to get a hold of folks, too. And I don't see where, at least for that area, on that first section, the elected officials, I think there are some issues, but I won't bring those up at this point. But the point is there has not been a rush of folks, people are doing this. And if I've brought out, there was a posting of the newspaper article on the web and a number of postings, and I gave it to the House side and the Senate side. Hopefully it was distributed to the senators, where people are, citizens wrote in, were saying, hey, you know, it's important for us to know where our elected officials live. We want to know who are making decisions about planning, blah, 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 where they live. So
thank you. Thank you. And I do think, I think we're aware of that. That was, I wasn't trying to cut you off, but I do think we understand those issues and those concerns. And so it's, you know, it's kind of up to this committee to make that decision. It sounds like the House has already made it its decision. Representative Simon has prepared an amendment if we prefer to be a step back from that level of disclosure, or, you know, so that's the decision for the House or the Senate members to make. Unless you wanted to offer the amendment regardless. I mean, I'm not sure what your feeling is on that.
Madam Chair, if I might, I'd like to offer the amendment because I think it's a reasonable compromise here. Again, one thing that we haven't discussed here but that you and I had a discussion about offline was this email requirement. We wanted to give people the choice of an email or telephone number, and I think that's in here too. Not everyone has email or wants email or uses email. So that's in here. And I appreciate Mr. Neumeister's concern. I would guess, if we're going to make choices here, I would elevate knowing how to get a hold of someone over knowing where they live. I understand that one is also important, but to me it's more important, and that's the value judgment that I make, to know how to get a hold of them. I don't need to know where Amy Klobuchar lives in Minneapolis or where she lives in when she's in Washington in suburban Virginia, I understand, at Arlington or Alexandria or something like that. I just need to know how to get a hold of her. All of us do. So I'm less concerned. I'm not saying it's not important. I'm saying, in my judgment, it's less important. And so from the public standpoint, as long as they can get a hold of that soil and water commissioner or whomever, I think that's the most important thing. And the other just anecdotal thing I wanted to mention, and Representative Lesh would have an insight into this. I'm told that just over the weekend, a friend of mine told me that he was applying for a job as a prosecutor at Ramsey County Attorney's Office. And they said, if you get the job, the first thing you're going to have to do is unlist your address and phone number at all prosecutors, at least at the county level, I don't know. You don't want some, particularly for some of these serious crimes, you don't want some gangbanger trying to firebomb your house. And I don't mean to be flip about that. I mean, federal prosecutors, other prosecutors do that routinely. Shouldn't we want to have a prosecutor maybe serve on a board on law enforcement without having to show where she lives?
Mr. Chair, that's all the gangbangers know where I live, and they enter at their own risk.
Sure.
Senator Limmer.
I would just say I'll move it.
Okay. Representative Simon has moved the S3235A8 amendment. Any further discussion? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if Representative Simon might entertain splitting the amendment. I think lines 1.6 down to 1.14 might be divisible. And we could take that first or the other one first, but I have to agree with those who claim that maybe some type of public address should be available to the public. If we could perhaps on Senator Representative Simon's agreement, we could do one or the other.
Ms. Pontius may have drafted an amendment that would address an approximate address. Do we have an amendment like that? We don't. Okay, we did talk beforehand about this issue, about trying to come up with some type of a way to define an approximate address while still protecting someone, like the nearest cross street address or the voting priest, something like that,
I'm
so
sure
that you would have to. Senator Limmer?
I guess I'm trying to figure out what purpose would that provide to the public who wants to talk to, influence, question whoever that individual is. Are you going to go down to the corner and wait to see him walk by, or how does that work?
No, the idea, Senator Limmer, would be that you would have an ability to contact them because you are going to have a mailing address and either a phone number or email address, but you would not be able to just go confront them in person, say at their home, if you were unhappy with something that they did on a volunteer board. So that would be the difference. I think as elected officials, we are required to list our addresses, you know, so I don't know that that's an issue. I'm not sure. I know I had to put it in so many different places. I'm just assuming it's a requirement. But again, you know, this is up to whatever the will of this committee will be. And if you want to, are you willing to split your Representative Simon?
Well,
or would you like to just see it go up and down first, how it goes?
You know, I'd like to see it go up and down first, I guess.
Madam Chair?
Okay. Sarah Limmer?
If we're going to go that way, I'll withdraw my opportunity to divide the amendment. But what I'd like to do is have more of a discussion then of what is the problem that we're trying to solve. Is there an outbreak of people wanting to go talk to people that are working on behalf of government officials? Are we having attacks on people? What are we trying to solve with this then if we're trying to not disclose addresses of people working for the public interest?
Is there anyone here in the audience who can speak on in defense of the decision that was made not to disclose this information before the
Spire Kopensky? The legislature in 2005 did an amendment to this section, and after that there was a commissioner's advisory opinion that basically said the list that you had given, which was city of residence, name, of a few select data elements, was just a partial restatement of the general presumption, so that those things were public as well as everything else. And then after that commissioner's opinion, there were two AG's opinion, then another advisory opinion, and then now that we have the Bureau of Pollution Control came in with a temporary classification. So what the commissioner has classified as private based on data is similarly treated is just the home contact data for people who are not in elected positions, who are not subject to the open appointments process. So really your ad hoc advisory groups, that's the kind of home contact information that is currently protected by the temporary classification. And you will see it next year unless, of course, you act on this now. But this has clearly been an area of confusion, and I am really hopeful that you will find some way to address it, because clearly we have a lot of confusion around this section.
Sarah Moy?
Ms. Byer-Kopensky, did the department have some input in bringing this language to the legislature?
Madam Chair and members, Senator Betzold introduced what the department's first take of the language might be. Representative Holberg in committee offered her suggestion. We worked with Representative Holberg to kind of tweak the language a little bit, so we've been providing some assistance there. But clearly our goal is to do something to address this. And in the midst of doing all that, we had this application for temporary classification, which the commissioner then acted on. So either way, you will have seen it, or you will decide it. It's been on its way to you in a variety of capacities.
Well, I was wondering where this came from, and I guess my concern is that on something I just checked with my office. It was Senator Betzel's bill. It was introduced in March, but there was no companion in the House for it, and that was one of the reasons why. I think given the number of issues that we had to address, we saw this as something that was potentially very controversial. And so the Judiciary Committee did not give it a hearing. And it is because of this very conversation that we purposely looked to see whether or not there was a companion. If the department had brought this to Senator Betzel, I guess I'm a little bit concerned that a companion wasn't introduced so that we could give it some priority and have a full hearing on it.
Madam Chair, I just checked my file. It was an agency bill, and, of course, it had to go through the governor's office, and it was released by Senator Clark to me. And like all the agency bills typically are, they come in quite late, and they all came in right before the deadline. So I introduced it just as soon as it was released to me. So I don't know what happened, obviously, on the House side. But by the time I got it and got it introduced, it was we were already, I think, bumping up against the committee deadlines, and we may have already passed the last hearing for the data practice subcommittee. So I think that, you know, just the timing. But I took it on because it was, as I say, the temporary classification bill, and I figured it had to be introduced. But somebody in the governor's office sat on these bills, and, you know, that's what happens every year.
Whose amendment was it, Representative Simon?
Representative Simon?
Madam Chair, I think it was Representative Holbergen.
Well, we
Madam
have...
Chair, if I could just add one thing. The temporary classification that I described will be in place until June 1st of 2010. So that was one of the reasons in working with Senator Betzel that it was not as urgent to get it addressed, because clearly the data as to these subset of people was going to be protected until 2010, when the legislature would have an opportunity to act. So it was not urgent to do it this session.
Well, members, it sounds like we have another alternative then, if there's a temporary classification that addresses this, which would be to have a hearing on this entire thing next session. Representative Hortman?
Madam Chair, I think this is really an important provision, and I hope that I don't know that we're ready to make a decision on it today, but I hope that when we are ready to decide, we include this language, because what we are doing a lot of here at the legislature, and what the governor is doing a lot of, is appointing subgroups of citizens to make policy decisions. And I think when citizens are making public policy decisions in the state of Minnesota, Minnesotans have a right to know who they are and where they're from. One example would be on the Climate Change Advisory Group. There were lobbyists from out of state representing corporate interests. People wanted to know who's on the group. If this is the governor's plan, if this is going to be Minnesota's plan on climate change, who are these parties who are participating as Minnesota citizens and Minnesota stakeholders? So I think whether it's in the city of Brooklyn Park and the Planning Commission, and you want to have, as a citizen of the city of Brooklyn Park, some weigh in about where a strip mall should be or whether the decks should now be allowed to be, you know, purple, you should be able to contact people who are making public decisions, even if they are not elected officials, because I think we do a lot of this here at the state level. My city has a budget advisory commission. They're making, as far as I can tell, more budget decisions than the city council. And I just think that if citizens have a meaningful right to participate in their government, they need to know how to find those individuals.
Representative Hortman, have you discussed with Representative Simon, or have you looked at the alternative or with language? What I'm going to suggest is we've had a good discussion on this subject. An amendment's been introduced that some of you may not have seen before. So why don't we take a little time to think about this in light of the potential alternatives we have here, which are, you know, adopting the language as it stands, as the House has it now, not adopting it and letting it and having hearing next session, or adopting it with the amendment. Those are kind of our three choices, and we can maybe have a little discussion about that and a little time to think about which would be the better way to go. Okay? Okay, then, moving on to on same page, R9-1, school background checks. This was a bill that... I think this is your bill in standalone form, and it was a position that was adopted in the Senate. And from what Ms. Pontius tells us, the language is very similar in the standalone bill you have in the House, if not almost identical. So, Representative Simon, how would you like to handle this at this stage?
I actually think it is, if it's not identical, it's very, very close. I haven't checked it word for word. If staff can... I'm being told here by Mr. Gearing that it's mostly stylistic, or it is stylistic, not mostly. So if that's true, Ms. Pontius, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's true. Actually, there is a grammatical correction that should be made in the Senate language that's okay in the House bill, if you choose to go that way. Otherwise, it is stylistic.
Okay. Could you tell us what that change should be?
Madam Chair, members, on working on R9 on page 4, line 26 of the Senate language, You would delete there and insert the individuals.
Madam Chair, I would move that amendment, that oral amendment, on line 4.26 to strike the word there and add in its place the word the individuals. That's L apostrophe, yes.
All those in favor of that amendment as described, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Motion passes.
And Madam Chair, I would move adoption then of the Senate language as amended.
Representative Simon has moved adoption of the Senate language in Senate 6 as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Motion passes. So then we're moving on to page R10, the section with regard to performance measurements, which is in the House language.
Could we take also 7?
I'm sorry.
Representative Simon?
I'm sorry. I just want to clarify the prior motion. Did we just adopt Section 6 of the Senate language, or did we adopt Section 6, 7, and
8? Madam Chair, I think he said Section 6, so I was wondering. I think.
Do you want to move the other section?
Yeah, I would just to make sure, assuming that the prior motion was just Section 6, I'll move the adoption of the Senate language in Sections 7 and 8 as well.
Thank you. I think that was my mistake in how I phrased it. But Representative Simon has moved Sections 7 and 8 as well. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. The performance measurement language. Is there anyone on the House side who would like to introduce and describe this? Or Representative Simon, would you like to?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This is an amendment that was offered and adopted from Representative Abler, and he apparently did consult, I'm told, with the Department of Health. I know that Representative Thiessen on the House side said he was fine with this from the standpoint of health policy, but I do have one question I'll just raise. See what members think about this. If you look on page R11 on the House language line 1014 and 1015, I'm not sure, since there are institutions that are enumerated, specific institutions, why we would leave an exception that could swallow the list there of the words "and other research institutions." I'm not quite sure what that means, and it could mean anything. If someone could maybe enlighten us, I would. My thinking would be to strike the words on line 10.14 "and other research," and then the word "institutions," comma, on line 10.15, simply because why enumerate any institutions if it's just all research institutions? I don't know what members think about that, but.
And how, members of the Senate, again, for those of you who may not have been there, we did have a considerable testimony. This was a bill. We had took considerable testimony about this in committee. And that was, I think, the language that we were, again, concerned about, I think, as well. And so we were going to look at an amendment, and we decided just to basically deal with this in conference committee. So I'm wondering whether there's anyone here from the university, from the medical school, who would have an objection or could tell us whether deletion of that language would create a problem. Is there anyone here who wants to testify to whether that's going to be a problem or not? If this is acceptable? No one here right now? Okay. I take that back then. What I said earlier, I was confusing that with the bill you had, Senator Betzold, for HCMC,
which
we're going to be getting to
later. That's later.
This is not something that we had introduced as a bill, so this is not language that we've heard discussed or had before. Senator Moi?
Representative Simon, was this some language that was intended to go into the health, like the health care access bill or like the health bill, but they missed the opportunity and it had a potential vehicle, so they put it in here?
Representative Simon?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Moi. That seemed plausible to me. I can't say that I know that for a fact. That seems like it would be plausible. Again, this is just summary data, as I understand it, and I'm a little handicapped by the fact that, the author of this piece isn't here with us, but if anyone else can correct me, if they understand something different or extra, let me know.
Do we know whether this language is in the health care reform bill on the Senate side? We don't know. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Bitzel?
If we are going to be revisiting, then again, possibly if Representative Abler wants to let us know a little bit more background. One of the issues, of course, that I would note on page 10, line 9, we have a report due to the legislature by December 15, 2008, and which means there'll be somebody's going to hurry up to provide a report. It's going to sit around for a whole month before anybody looks at it because, so I normally would like to see it, unless there's a real reason to have it, by January 1509 rather than December 1508. But that's just something we can revisit if we get back to this particular issue.
Okay. Well, once again, this seems to be something where we didn't have a bill or a hearing. And since we don't have Senator or Representative Abler here right now, why don't we move past this one for now, and then perhaps if we're going to be meeting again, which seems more unlikely all the time, maybe Representative Abler can be here to talk to us about the need for this one. So then we move, jump ahead to R13-1, sharing confinement data. Do we have someone who wants to talk on behalf of the House's position on this? Is this yours, amendment, Representative De La Forest?
Madam Chair, no.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Is there anyone who wants to explain how the Commissioner of Deed can report prison immigration data or why they would want to do that?
Oops. Never mind.
Bring the bureaucrat to us.
Representative Lilly.
No, I thought she was coming up.
Anyone who puts their hand up is going to get called out on this one, so
we
be careful.
We don't have to have people testify.
No, I know we don't have to have people testify, but you know, in talking about this privately, I have to say there were so many questions raised by this that no one seems to have answers for, that it's hard to imagine how we can really even sort of rationally discuss this. Because, first of all, how could the Commissioner of Deed do this anyway? It seems to be an impossibility. So unless anyone wants to speak in defense of this, I don't think we have any reason why we'd want to accept it. Representative Hortman?
Madam Chair, I don't want to speak in defense of it. I support your decision to get it out. I think the intent of the author was to determine the number of inmates in state correctional facilities who are immigrants, in particular immigrants who are not here lawfully. And I think that the amendment was poorly drafted, and I can speak for all the people in my area of the House, not thoroughly understood at the time that it was voted on, because the amendment was distributed very late. And the Speaker had called for a vote before people had a chance to read the entire amendment. So rather than something that came through any sort of legislative process and was considered and gathered as determining whether this really made sense, it was kind of a very on-the-fly provision, and I hope that we'll take it out.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a person who seeks always to uphold the House position when I can, I think this was Representative Seifert's amendment, wasn't it? And I remember reading it on the floor and trying to find out the language. The identity of any inmate whose immigration status cannot be determined is public. I was trying to determine that at the time. And I think maybe I'll just, in lieu of maybe us putting this in here, make a recommendation to Representative Seifert that he assemble a blue ribbon commission to determine how you may determine the identities of inmates whose immigration status cannot be determined. And I think if he does that, we can maybe bring this back next year.
Okay. Representative Lesh, I think that's a fine suggestion, considering I've been told, first of all, that this is already done anyway in terms of the data gathering process that has to do with citizenship, and that it wouldn't be something that would happen under deed. in any case, and that it, no one really quite understands what this is even intended for or what the purpose would be served by it. So why don't we, since we don't have anyone here to answer those questions, move past this then, and if someone comes back with something next year that, you know, that seems to be necessary or that can be explained, then we can certainly take a look at it at that point. Representative Simon?
Thank you. I understand they're really in Section 19 here, all the portions contained on page R14. My understanding is that it is a distinct provision distinct from what we've just discussed, and that is lines 13.35 to 14.2. I think that's separate. And I'd be interested in hearing a 30-second take, if
sure,
you indulge that, Madam Chair, from someone from the department to see whether that is something that they do want.
Thank you for pointing that out, Representative Simon. I didn't flag those things separately, and I think that is a different point. And would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Sure. My name is Barbara Cox, and I'm from the Department of Corrections. The first provision came from a bill that Chairs Paymar and Higgins had relating to reentry, and that particular provision was taken out of that reentry bill so that the entire bill did not have to go to data privacy. Right. It's a provision that the department supports and seeks because when offenders come into the prison system and we're seeking to best work with their job skills and their future reentry plans and their education while they're in the correctional institution, it would be helpful for us to know their past employment history. We already, last year, the legislature granted us access to post-confinement employment data through Deed, which Deed supported, so that when they left the correctional facility and were no longer under the jurisdiction of the corrections commissioner, we could get data on whether or not our reentry efforts were successful. And it is possible for us to get some of that information when the offenders come into our reception center, but sometimes they are not reliable, and sometimes they just don't. Sometimes they're not truthful as well.
And members, I did discuss this provision with Senator Higgins, who asked for our support of this, but I think it's also in another bill that's traveling separately. So would someone like to move the language? Senator Moore, do you have a question?
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, I just checked. You know, this language is in the finance bill, in the bigger finance bill, because there's some potential financial impact. Ms. Cox?
Madam Chair, Senator Moy, I was not aware that it was in the finance bill, actually. It's in Senator Tomasoni has an unemployment
It's in that bill.
But I'm not sure that it's in the House companion to that bill.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, I'll move House Section 19 with the exception of the new language on 14.3 to 14.5, which I believe was the floor amendment that we discussed.
All those in favor of Senator Betzold's motion, say aye.
Sorry,
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, there's just some other technical new language that's not on 14.3 to 14.5. So I think if the committee wanted to adopt this language, you would want to adopt Section 19, lines 13.35 to 14.2, and also line 14.16, the effective date.
Next page.
If I understand,
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I understood the motion, it was to adopt the entire section minus the language 14.3 to 14.5, which I assume would mean it would include the effective date of 14.16.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, that's correct. There's just on line 14.6 and 14.12, there are paragraph lettering sections that don't need to be there.
That would have to be reverted back, right?
Okay.
I see.
So, Senator Betzold, are you satisfied with the description there?
Yes. Move to adopt Section 19, except for the lines in 14.3 to 14.5, and then correct the internal references of 14.6 to 14.12.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
So what have we done?
That's out.
This didn't include it, I know.
No, I
okay.
I'm not going to do it. rules that it does.
Thank you.
When I'm finished, they have to go to caucus. We're going to discuss one more section here that I think we can do quickly. Section on page R15.1 on the House side, there's a provision that deals with Social Security's numbers being visible on the face of mailings. And what this had to do with was apparently it came to the attention of someone that when a person wins the lottery, for example, they're required to fill out a postcard, which has to include their Social Security number on the outside of the postcard, and they're not allowed to even put it in an envelope when they send it in. So that Social Security number becomes visible as it's going through handling through the mail. And so the intent of this amendment, which I don't think was introduced as a bill on the Senate side, was it, Representative Simon?
Madam Chair, it was not. It was after deadline. Just a little bit more background. Representative Zellers.
So apparently, members, this didn't come to anyone's attention until it was after deadline. I had some concern. I was confused when I read this, but when the reference to the face of the mailings, it seemed as though it could refer to something on the face of an inside letter, even though it was inside an envelope, and it just seemed confusing to me. So an amendment has been prepared, which has been handed out to you, the A11 amendment, which I guess I haven't had a chance to look at. So why don't maybe we can just take a quick minute to look at this. Well, I guess this amendment makes it clearer to me what we're talking about, so I like this language better. Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, if you look at line 1.7, the title of the subdivision is Prohibition on Use of Social Security Numbers on Face of Mailings. Perhaps maybe a more definitive word to put in here would be a Social Security number on outer face of mailings.
Senator Limmer, I think, yeah, the on face of mailings was in place because that was the language before it was corrected. And I'm not even sure if the face...
It doesn't appear within the language.
What is? Maybe there's it on the outside of mailings. Or maybe we should just say prohibition on visible use of Social Security number on mailings.
Well, but Madam Chair, part of the reason why... If somebody wins the lottery and they want that, I mean, the lottery commission needs the Social Security number for reporting purposes of income. So, I mean, I just think that maybe the issue we're trying to address is not the bill. It's the underlying issue of how the lottery commission wants somebody to claim their prize. Give them the information.
This can't be on the outside.
Senator Moi, it isn't that they can't get the Social Security numbers. That's not what this says. Oh. It's that it can't be, because what they're doing is they required you to put it on a postcard and then send it through the mail without being able to put the postcard inside an envelope so you could protect the visibility of the Social Security number. And it may not just be the lottery. It's probably other things as well. And so what we're trying to do is say it can't be visible on the outside of the mailing. I think that's what this amendment is intended to address. So if we could just perhaps change the heading, is that what you're suggesting, Senator Limmer?
Just add a word that says number on and then add outside or outer face of mailing.
Representative Hortman?
Senator Limmer, what if we just deleted the words face of?
On use of Social Security numbers of mail.
Well,
Representative Simon.
I just wanted to point out, as it's been pointed out to me many times, that judges do not construe, when they're construing this language, the headings have no legal meaning.
No,
only the text. So we can call it prohibition on, you know, we can call it what we want, but it's the text that matters. So.
Okay. So on Senator Limmer's, or on this.
I'll withdraw my amendment. I don't think it's necessary then, if that's the case.
Okay. Well, in that situation, in that case, then, any other questions or discussion on the language, Senator Betzel?
Well, this did seem familiar to me, and I think, yeah, the Social Security law that is yet to go into effect does already provide something, you know, similar to that. That bill's in conference committee right now that Senator Scheid and I are on, and on the is there Paraso and Representative Holberg, Representative Hellstrom, and Representative Simon. So there is some language that we're already dealing with, you know, in a different bill in the Social Security number. That, you know, we could put it here, but we've already got it. It's in fact, it's already in statute. It just hasn't taken effect yet.
Oh. How does this is
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Betzel, I think there's maybe some overlap, but I think this is broader, actually, than the scope of the conference committee that we're on. And there may even be federal law that comes into play when it comes to mailing, but the requiring that someone mails. If you saw this thing that Representative Zellers had, it would sort of shock you. I've seen it. And it's a postcard. Oh. And it says, it's a postcard. It says, write your Social Security number and send this in to claim your winnings. And it explicitly says, if you put this in an envelope, you know, it will be void or something to that effect. Like, you may not put it in an envelope. You must send through the mails in a postcard your Social Security number. And so I'm not so sure that our other committee gets it at this. There may be some overlap, sure. But I think it would give me comfort to adopt this language or the amendment or something like it, because I'm not sure we cover it in the other committee.
Well, it's...
Senator Betzel?
Well, again, Representative Simon, it's written in the statute right now. The statute just hasn't taken effect yet because we delayed it. It was supposed to have gone into effect in 07 and now it's been delayed. So, I mean, our conference committee is dealing with some other language in there, but, and I think probably Ms. Pontius is trying to seek out at 325E, if I remember right, 59. Maybe we can just hold on for a few minutes because... Whatever we do here, I'd like to make sure we're consistent with the other one so we don't have different things going on here. So, why don't we just get a copy of the statute and we can also take a look at that. So.
Representative Simon?
Just one other point. I mean, I think of our other committee as the Social Security number bill that prohibits selling of a Social Security number.
Right.
And this seems to go beyond that. This is the state saying, for whatever purpose, a licensure purpose, claiming your winnings in a lottery, not really selling, but something broader than that, that you can't make someone fill out the kind of document that Representative Zellers showed us all. That's where I think this goes beyond that. But
well, let's wait a minute or two until we can double-check with counsel and see what it does say. So.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Schein? I mean, Senator Schein? Sorry.
Well, I used to be. That's okay.
That's his life.
That the other bill relates, I think, to the private use, the private sector, whereas this is about government entities. So I don't think it conflicts. This is pretty probably clearer, actually, than the other.
Senator Betzel, Ms. Pontius agrees with that representation. Okay. So, is there anyone who isn't comfortable with this language? Okay. So, can we just? Do you want to move the bill then, Representative?
Well, I think the amendment. Which first.
Amendment?
Okay.
I'll move the amendment.
With the.
The amendment. We did an amendment. Okay.
It's the A11 amendment.
A11 amendment.
Odd head note.
So Representative Simon moves the A11 amendment, and all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Then Representative Simon, do you want to move for inclusion then? The A11. Oh, I guess the A11, it's basically a delete all, so I guess we did adopt it then. Okay. The only thing that we have left of substance, except to come back to the things that we've already talked about, are we have the business screening, which is a fairly substantial provision, which has to do with treatment of conviction and criminal record information. And there's a requirement that this has to be looked at. I think basically it's, is it 30 days or does it say a month? No.
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel?
Senate Judiciary Committee, it had said 30 days and we amended it to say monthly.
Okay, and we have had quite a bit of discussion on this on the Senate side. I'm not sure in terms of a position on the House side,
Representative Simon.
Wait a minute. This, yes, Madam Chair, thanks. This was a bill. This was a Representative Mary Liz Holberg bill. It was heard in the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee, and it was actually, there was a vote on it. I believe it may even have been a roll call vote, and it was defeated.
Okay. And this is a position that I think that the Senate feels probably pretty strongly about because we have spent quite a bit of time on this over a substantial period of time. And so maybe it's one of those things that we're going to want to, again, we're not going to, I know you have a time commitment here to have to be leaving, but maybe one of those things we're going to try to resolve mm-hmm. through some discussion if we can and see if we can come to terms or come to an agreement on that provision. And then the final provision, Section 14, which has to do with an electronic exchange of information. Now, this, I think, is the HCMC provision, is it?
Section 23.
Section 23.
Okay, Section 23. And this is something where we were able to, we had some questions about the language of, and so an amendment has been prepared, which basically just clarifies the language. I don't think it changes anything substantively, does it, Ms. Pontius? And so I think if, because we really didn't, Senator Betzel?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the House had apparently adopted the language as it was introduced. It was actually drafted, I think, by an assistant Hennepin County attorney, which is just another example why you should not try this at home. Leave it to the professionals. And so we actually, when we looked at it in committee, we actually had some modified language, and the person who actually drafted this language actually liked the Senate language better because it was actually, I believe that this is, well, this is a little bit, this is slightly different from what we actually had, but I think the ones that Hennepin County brought in was just too awkward, so.
Okay. Well, House members, if you've had a chance to look through this and if you're satisfied that this language accomplishes what you liked and HCMC is happy with it, maybe happier than their original language, I would just appreciate it then if you would support the language and we can just move it.
Madam Chair, I'm looking over at Representative from HCMC and he looks pleased.
Looks pleased.
Steve, we had a lot of questions about the original language.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could bring your attention to page 1, line 9. There's a reference for the purposes of this medical data, treatment, payment, or health care operations. What would be the definition of health care operations? It seems rather broad to me.
Ms. Pontius?
Well,
I'm thinking that was the language in the original bill, and so maybe we can have someone from HCMC come up and describe for us the difference between, I mean, treatment or payment seems pretty obvious, but beyond that, healthcare operations, I guess I'm thinking that there might be discussions between doctors about how to handle something that might not fall under the category of treatment, but I'm not sure what that's intended to reference. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name's Andy Mitchell. I'm the awkward assistant Hennepin County attorney who drafted the original language and likes this language better. This language, which being awkward was chosen by us, refers to treatment, payment, or healthcare operations, which is language we took out of the federal HIPAA language, and we used it because it's now become kind of a term of art to mean that in addition to seeking payments, if you have a peer review process within your hospital, that kind of healthcare operations would also be included in this language.
Thank you very much for your very lucid explanation, and we appreciate that. And I thought it was probably something, you know, that would like that. So does that answer your question, Senator Limmer?
So did I hear this right, Madam Chair? It refers to, did I hear peer review?
For example, Senator Limmer, if there were a situation where there was a question about a doctor's handling of a medical case, and there were like a quality assurance committee meeting or something at the hospital where they were talking about that particular procedure, it would allow them to exchange that kind of information, and I would think that would be a good thing. Because they're basically, the reason they're asking for this provision is this is kind of operating as one entity,
Madam Chair, I think for the purposes of us making a decision, that might be okay to consider it that, but what about the legal representatives of hospitals 10 or 12 years down the road, and they're going to look at healthcare operations, and they aren't going to have access to this recording? They may think that it's much broader than that. I was wondering if perhaps we might have a little more definitive term for healthcare operations that might be more to the point. Healthcare operations could mean just about anything, don't you think?
Mr. Mitchell, would it be possible to cross-reference this to a do you know if there is a definition somewhere in law, in state or federal law, or?
I believe that, I know we took this term out of the Health Information Portability Act, HIPAA. I believe it's defined there, but I need to look that up.
Mr. Neumeister, do you know the answer to that?
Madam Chair, I want to be able to address the amendment in a way that might be able to be helpful.
Okay.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm an open records and privacy advocate. The issue is, you've got to remember, we have two different statutes. The state law is more restrictive for privacy than HIPAA is. So you're taking a HIPAA standard, trying to fit it into this kind of standard. My suggestion, if it's only for peer review, and that's what has been already stated, just define, go to a peer review statute or refer for peer review. That's my point.
Okay. Senator Betzel?
No, the purpose here is the fact that Hennepin County Medical Center computerized their medical records. The doctors who work at Hennepin County Medical Center have also created this nonprofit corporation, which is basically across the street. And I think in reviewing HIPAA and the other laws, they can't, sitting in their offices across the street, access the computerized records that they have access to when they go over to the hospital. They would like to be able to, go to one place where their office is located and have this access to the very same information they have access to in the unit, except that Hennepin County Medical Center and this nonprofit physicians corporations are two different entities, so legally they can't share the ward information with the very same doctors who are now sitting in their own in the other offices. So I think this is what it's intended to do, is to simply allow them access to those computerized records, just like they could bring a chart across the street before. Now they can just tap into the computer. It's got nothing to do with peer review.
Well, Senator Limmer, I'm satisfied. You may not be, but I'm satisfied that this is a term of art, and that it's narrowly drawn to these particular facilities. But since we're not doing final adoption of anything at this point, if we move this and you wanted to come back with an amendment because you find that you can tie it to something that makes you feel more comfortable, I'm sure we would consider that.
Well, Madam Chair, you're correct. I'm not ready to support this amendment at this time. If healthcare operations truly is a term of art, then I'd like to see that definition of what that term of art is. I think that's important for our discussion and our ultimate decision. And I'd like to hold on this decision until we get that term of art before us.
I think we can do that. Senator Scheib?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I'm probably way out in left field on this, but I was concerned about the word payment on line 1.9, and I know it's in the House bill as well, just concerned as far as it relates to the medical debt issue. And I don't think it does, but because I guess these are the same folks, the same people. I don't like the word folks. Same people.
Well, and Senator Schein, I guess I'm, again, that was probably adopting original language, but usually when I see something like this, it's not talk. They don't usually say payment. They usually say billing.
Well,
you know, so if it's intended to be for billing purposes, that's usually the language more often used, I would think. Wouldn't you, Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Well, why don't we just perhaps take a little bit of time to maybe tweak this amendment a little bit further or think about it a little bit more. But it seems as though everybody wants to get this done for and isn't opposed to this philosophically. It's just a little bit of language tweaking we need to do.
Madam Chair, are you saying that it clearly has, because it may be very clear to everybody else here, that it has nothing to do with the legislation that we have on medical debt information not being able to be shared by a health care provider?
Senator Scheid, I think this would still be subject to that law. This is not an exception to that. It's just allowing between these two facilities to share with each other. Right.
Thank you.
Ms. Pontius concurs. So,
thank you.
Okay. We really appreciate the time of everyone for being here. We've actually gotten through everything, at least preliminarily. And so, Senator, our Representative Simon and I will talk. I have a commitment tonight until 7:30, so I don't think it's going to be possible.
I assume that we will meet on another day other than today. We're not sure which one yet.
But we're going to try to do this as quickly as we possibly can, and would prefer to get this wrapped up sooner in the week rather than later if possible. So we'll be checking with everyone's schedules and trying to get another date set as quickly as possible. Senator Schein?
I'm sorry, did we deal with the explosives?
We didn't deal with the explosives. I don't know how I should have missed that one.
I just thought maybe I missed.
Okay. I'm sorry. I apologize. There is a provision in the House language that I don't think that's going to take us much time to wrap up. Unless, did you have a question or a comment?
Madam Chair,
right now?
Oh, it's kind of crazy, but I recall, and I just need to look at Chapter 299F, I guess, to see what other kind of requirements there are when people are going to use explosives, for example, in a neighborhood, and it's authorized by government, and I want to know about it. Because, believe it or not, last year on the bad faith bill, an insured came forth because they weren't able to collect when the city hadn't told them they'd be dynamiting near their home. So, you know, I just want to look at that. Because if it's private, you know, if it's not public, I'm not sure if it says private or non-public. Anyway, I assume they have notice requirements, but I just want to see that. So
okay.
I'd rather not deal with it right now, but I'm sure it's fine.
Okay. So thank you all for being here. Meeting is adjourned.